costs as far as seems to have been.
I mean, the timing of the forecast seems to be right, but the...
Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to call the meeting of the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board to order. Everybody has received a packet in the mail. The first item of business is the adoption of the consent agenda, which contains both the proposed agenda for today and the June meeting minutes. Has everybody had a chance to review the consent agenda? And if so, is there a motion to approve?
I so moved.
Second.
Moved by John, seconded by Charlie. Any discussion? Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Consent agenda is approved. Next item on the agenda is introductions. Oftentimes, accompanied with introductions, we give a short summary of what's going on in the various agencies. Today, I would ask that we just do the introduction of the individual representing the agency. We have a packed agenda, and I'm hoping to get everybody out of here by 4 o'clock as it is. So, Tom, if you could start, we'll do a round of introductions.
Tom Landwehr, I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources.
Kristen Ide-Tollison, citizen member from Southeast Minnesota.
Mike Rothman, the Commerce Commissioner.
Will Seifert, Environmental Quality Board Director.
Brian Napstead, Chair of the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Charlie Zelli, Commissioner, Department of Transportation.
John Linkstein, Commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Julie Ganning, citizen member from Moorhead.
John Saxog, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Tom Moebi, citizen board member, Cottage Grove.
Adam Dunnick, Chairman of the Metropolitan Council.
Okay, thank you for that. And I'd like to welcome all of our guests, staff, and visitors with us today. Moving on to the next item is the chair's report. I am actually the vice chair of the EQB. The chairman, Dave Fredrickson, the Commissioner of Agriculture, is unable to be here today, so I'm sitting in his place as vice chair. With that, I will move on from to the next report, which is the executive director's report.
Thank you, Chairman Napstad. Just a couple quick things for the board. Just first want to thank everybody for their participation in the CZO event that we held on July 20th. This was a very successful conclusion to a pretty long project that we have been working with your agencies to manage identifying different climate policies and trying to model economic and emissions impacts from those policies. You know, we continue to take advantage of opportunities to present the findings of the report, and we'll continue to do so as we move into the rest of this year and into next year. And we're also going to continue to work with your agencies on developing these policies so that they may be proposed and enacted and implemented in the coming years. A brief staff update. At the beginning of the month, Anna Henderson started a new position as the governor's water policy advisor. This will help advance much of the work that we've been collaborating on with the governor's office. Anna's helped lead and facilitate a number of critical EQB policy projects and reports over the past few years, most notably our CZO report, our climate change report, and our 2015 water policy report. So we're going to miss her leadership, passion, and intellect, but we do wish her the best and look forward to continuing collaborating with her just in a different setting. We're going to begin filling this vacancy here in the upcoming weeks. So any suggestions or recommendations you might have, I'm all ears. On Monday, we facilitated a workshop at the Minnesota Zoo with your agencies and a handful of others that don't sit on the EQB to define statewide goals and indicators to report on the health of our pollinator species in Minnesota. I'm really excited that some of our colleagues are here to present the full scope of state efforts on this issue and the results of the workshop here shortly. At the start of July 2016, we started our, as you recall from a presentation a couple months back, our 2016 EQB Environment Review Survey started to go out for distribution automatically as different governmental units submitted their materials online, their environmental review materials. The goal of the survey is to assess the technical assistance provided by the EQB and collect feedback on the perceived effectiveness of environmental review. So far, we've received responses from nearly 50% of RGUs invited to complete the survey, and about 70% of citizens invited to complete the survey. So good survey responses. We'd like to see a little bit of a better number for our RGU responsiveness, but so far, so good, and Mark will make a presentation at the end of the year with the results that we're seeing. One other thing I want to just call your attention to here is in front of you here, there's a draft project charter for our environmental Congress. So to remind you, February 3rd, we're planning our environmental congress. Right now we have an RFP out to try and get a bid for a venue. We don't have time on the agenda today to go through this, but I would ask you, all our board members, to read through this and follow up with me if you have any questions or advice. At this point, it's most important that we identify lead agency representatives on our planning team. And so a number of your agencies have already identified people. Those agencies that haven't, I'll follow up with you offline at a later date. But if you have any questions or advice on this, please don't hesitate to ask. Otherwise, our next meeting on October 19th, we're going to hear a petition pertaining to health impact assessments for certain categories of our environmental review rules.
That it, Will?
That is it.
Okay. Any questions for Will? Any questions? If not, I know the board wishes Anna Henderson very well also. She made a lot of contributions to this board. I don't see her out in the audience today. As a reminder to the audience, this is being webcast, so hopefully if Anna is watching this webcast, we appreciate all your contributions. Moving on, the first action on the agenda today is designation of the Responsible Governmental Unit for Environmental Review. Courtney, welcome, Courtney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the microphone is on. Yes.
Yes.
So, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and board members. For the record, I am Courtney Allers-Nelson, and I'm the Planning Director for Environment Review here at EEQB. Today, I have a very short presentation on your decision to determine whether there should be a different responsible governmental unit for the environmental review of the proposed Spider Creek mitigation project. Again, this is a very short presentation. It's some abbreviated information from the information found in both the findings of fact and the conclusions of law in your board packet. So the request is, again, to designate a different responsible governmental unit for the environmental review of the proposed Spider Creek mitigation project, which is being proposed by the United States Steel Corporation. We received the request from the current RGU, which is St. Louis County. St. Louis County sent us a letter, and in the same letter in which they request to be relieved of their RGU status, they identified the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources as being the more appropriate responsible governmental unit for the review of the project. As for the proposed project, it is located in St. Louis County, and it is to convert Spider Creek and its adjacent riparian areas back to its natural conditions, thereby improving some floodplain storage in the watershed. The anticipated work on Spider Creek meets the threshold for an environmental assessment worksheet, and for that particular category, for stream diversion, the local unit of government is identified as the responsible governmental unit. Consequently, to designate a different responsible governmental unit in this situation, we need to look to Minnesota Rules 4410.0500, subpart 6. Subpart 6 says that if we're going to designate a different responsible governmental unit, we must determine that that new RGU, the DNR in this case, has greater expertise in analyzing the potential project impacts. So throughout the findings of fact, and with conversations and letters documented by St. Louis County and the Department of Natural Resources, we've come to the conclusion and the conclusions of law that the DNR does have greater expertise for this case. That is supported by their experience in studying and working in aquatic habitats, including the ecological impacts of flora and fauna for stream mitigation projects. They also have a history of public water permitting, which this project would require. And finally, they have experience with both state and federal collaboration, which this project may also require. So, Mr. Chair and board members, it comes down to your decision Your decision is based on whether we should designate a different responsible governmental unit for the project. And to be clear, a vote in the affirmative today will designate the DNR as the RGU for the proposed Spider Creek mitigation project. However, a vote against the resolution, again found in your board packet, will keep St. Louis County as the responsible governmental unit for the proposed project. Mr. Chair and board members, I will pause for a moment to see if there are any questions, as I did give a very abbreviated presentation of the materials in the board packet before there is a roll call.
Members, any questions or comments for Courtney? If not, proceed, Courtney.
Yes. Mr. Chair and board members, I have no further information, and we may proceed to a roll call.
Okay. We have the resolution in hand that was mailed out with the packet. The packet summarizes the comments Courtney made, the findings of facts, and conclusions that would seek to transfer the RGU status to the Department of Natural Resources. Is there a motion to approve the resolution?
So moved.
Moved by Commissioner Landwehr. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Commissioner Welly. Zelly, I'm sorry, our county engineer is Welly.
Oh, that's right.
Any further discussion on the resolution? Quick
observation. You know, we obviously we reviewed this. We believe that we're going to be involved in any event with respect to the waters permit, and find that this would be compatible with our analysis.
Thank you. We will be taking this on a roll call vote. Will?
Ms. Idy Tollefson?
Yay.
Ms. Gehring?
Yay.
Commissioner Landwehr?
Aye.
Mr. Moybe?
Yeah.
Commissioner Napstad?
Aye.
Commissioner Rothman?
Yes.
Mr. Saxog?
Yes.
Commissioner Linkstein?
Yes.
Commissioner Zelli?
Aye.
9 votes.
Motion is approved 9-0. Resolution is approved. RGU status has been changed. Thank you. Moving on to the next item on the agenda is the Interagency Pollinator Coordination Team update. While our speakers are getting prepared, I would like to remind anybody who wishes to testify regarding any items on the agenda today that there are these purple cards right over on the desk over there. Please fill out the card and hand it up to me so that I can call on you and so that I know which item you're wishing to testify on. We presently have individuals indicating interest on testifying on the Line 3 agenda item and the Clean Power Plan. With that, please introduce yourselves and welcome.
Hello, thank you for having us here today. My name is Vivian Place. I'm the Director of Government Affairs of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And Commissioner Fredrickson does send his regrets.
Winnie, could you turn your mic on?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. Sorry, not used to this fancy technology. with me today, I have Raj Mann, who conducted our neonicotinoid pesticide review. And Crystal Boyd is here to kind of explain the executive order in full. We're going to be focusing more on the Department of Agriculture items.
Thank you all for being here today.
So first I'm going to have Raj Mann kind of go through the neonicotinoid study that we conducted.
Mr. Chair and the board members and everybody, good afternoon. As Whitney said, I'm Raj Mann. I am a research scientist with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. So I would be speaking on the special registration review of neonicotinoids that the Department of Agriculture carried out. So before digging into the details of the review, I would like to let you know what the neonicotinoids are and why they are important. I'd like to say they are very important pest management tools, and we recognize that. They are systemic insecticides. Those provide very effective control of piercing and sucking insect pests such as aphids, and also some difficult to control pests such as emerald ash borer, Colorado potato beetle. They were initially registered as reduced risk pesticides by the US EPA because they are safe to applicators and farm workers. They are widely used for sea treatments, and sea treatments have their own advantages. Sea treatments provide efficient and prolonged control of insect pests when plants are small and they are most vulnerable to pests. And they also limit direct exposure to non-target organisms, except for in few cases like the planting dust. Alternative pesticides to neonicotinoids, especially the older classes such as organophosphates, that includes chlorpyrifos, synthetic pyrethroids, may be more toxic to bees, mammals, birds, and aquatic organisms, depending upon the what kind of pesticide that is. And an over-reliance of particular class of pesticide may result in increased resistance in insect populations, including the neonicotinoids. So pesticides have been related to the pollinator decline, and most of the researchers, they agree that there are several factors those are responsible for pollinator decline, and those include loss of habitat, diseases like viruses, bacteria, parasites, predators, and pests, most importantly, the varroa mites, pesticides, especially the insecticides, beekeeper practices, and also if we just talk about the managed bees, and also the climate change. So talking about the pesticides, what MDA is, how the MDA is responding to this pollinator decline. MDA previously reviewed neonicotinoid concerns as part of its emerald ash borer insecticide review that also included the concerns related to the pollinators. On November 5th, 2013, the Minnesota legislature directed Commissioner of Agriculture to initiate a special registration review of neonicotinoids for their impact on insect pollinators. So responding to that request, the MDA Pesticide Management Unit staff developed a scoping document in collaboration with the University of Minnesota, MPCA, DNR, Bowser, outlining six broad criteria on the basis of which the review was carried out. The draft scoping document was made available for public comments for little more than 1 month, and we received 444 comments. And MDA provided a written response to each and every unique comment and incorporated them into the scoping document whenever appropriate. And then we revised the scoping document and posted it online in October 2014. We also carried out a pollinator summit in February 2016. And while carrying out the review, we considered more than 300 peer-reviewed research articles and government documents. So the first criteria, federal, state, and other neonicotinoid registration policies and initiatives, the EPA registers the pesticide only when certain rules or when the certain data requirements are met. And based on those requirements, EPA registers the pesticide. But some concerns were acknowledged by the EPA in relation to the neonicotinoids and insect pollinators. So EPA amended labels to add bee icon to outdoor foliar uses of neonicotinoid products in 2013. And EPA also carries out a cyclical review of each and every pesticide after 15 years. And on that 15-year cycle, the neonicotinoids review is due by 2017. In addition, some Minnesota cities, 12 Minnesota cities, townships, school districts, including Minneapolis and St. Paul, have limited the use of neonicotinoid insecticides on the land they own. Canada's province of Ontario implemented new laws that require farmers to use treated seeds only when pest problems exist. And European Union enacted a moratorium for 2 years on use of imidacloprid, clothianidin, and thiamethoxam. These are the most widely used neonicotinoids to bee attractive crops. And that the outcome of that moratorium would be due by early 2017. Talking about the use of neonicotinoids in Minnesota, there are about 127,000 pounds of all neonicotinoids were sold in Minnesota as compared to chlorpyrifos. That was 16% higher in 2011. So neonicotinoids are not the one of the top insecticides used in Minnesota. It's less than the chlorpyrifos. And that accounted for 0.26% of all crop chemicals. And bulk of neonicotinoid sale in agricultural crops were from three neonicotinoid compounds. Those were clothianidin, thiamethoxam, and imidacloprid. These numbers are based on the use of neonicotinoids, that those are coming from the foliar or soil applications. That does not include the applications coming from the seed treatment, because state does not have the authority to manage the sale and use of pesticide-treated seeds, because they are considered as treated articles and they are exempt from all provisions of FIFRA. Based on estimates, about 90% of corn and about 40% of soybean acreage in Minnesota is planted with neonicotinoid treated seeds, and we do not have any records of those. So coming to the main focus of the review, that's the neonicotinoid risks to insect pollinators. As I said, neonicotinoids are systemic insecticides. They move systemically and they can stay in plants from days to months. They are highly toxic to bees and other pollinators, both through the contact and ingestion. They are toxic to pollinators at very low concentration. For example, the LD50 value for clothianidin is 0.0039 microgram per bee. And LD50 value is the value that would kill 50% of the bee populations at a given time. Like, they may be exposed for 24 hours, 48 hours, or 72 hours. They have a long half-life, although it depends upon several factors like soil type, climate, soil pH, and many more. The maximum half-life for the most commonly used neonicotinoids, those are the clothianidin, imidacloprid, thiamethoxam, is generally more than 1 year. And the pollinators may be exposed to neonicotinoids primarily via treated seed, planting dust, and through the contaminated plant parts. Those are the pollen and the nectar. So while detecting the pesticides in the beehives, pesticides including ones applied for managing bee pests are commonly detected in beehives. In one study, 161 pesticides were found in the honeybee hives, but the concentrations were low enough to cause immediate bee deaths from acute poisoning. But there could be sublethal impacts. Those could impact the bee orientation, their reproduction, their movement, etc. And neonicotinoid concentrations have been found to be up to 12,400 parts per billion from abraded dust from the treated seed. And the neonicotinoid concentrations in the pollen and nectar of plants have been found to be up to 8.6 times higher than the LD50 values for the honeybees. I want to point out over here is that the high concentrations would not always mean that it will kill the bees. The exposure to bees or the other pollinators depends upon several factors, such as the pollinator species. Certain bees may be more susceptible to the insecticide as compared to the others. Similarly, the pollen sources or the nectar sources, certain plants could be more attractive than the others. And there are also abiotic factors involved, like temperature, wind speed, and wind direction. So based on the review, MDA recommended 8 action steps. Those action steps included, first one is creating a treated seed program. As I mentioned, at present, the state does not have authority to manage the treated seeds, and this action would require a legislative action. If this action is approved, then the state will have authority to regulate the sale and use of pesticide-treated seeds. And through this program, we will also fund research on seed treatment products, such as efficacy of seed treatment rates, economic thresholds, planting technology differences, etc. Some studies have shown that in certain cases, seed treatments may not significantly improve the yield. So through this project, we will be funding the research to find out under which conditions the seed treatments are required, whether they are significantly improving the yields or not. And the program may require that untreated seeds and seeds treated at lower pesticide applications rates are available in the market. At present, it's very hard to find the untreated seeds. Our second step is to create a dedicated pollinator protection account. This step would also include a legislative action. And here our goal is to support activities related to pollinators through a dedicated pollinator protection account that is funded through a fees on sale of pesticide-treated seeds and on pesticides classified by the US EPA as moderately or highly toxic to pollinators that can impact the pollinators. So the pollinator protection account will be used to fund treated seed program and also to support other activities related to pollinators. Those may include support research on pesticide seed treatments, developing economic thresholds, etc. Develop an educational campaign on use of pesticides, and also to develop stewardship materials like BMPs. The third step is where the department would develop a plan to require a formal verification of need prior to use of neonicotinoid pesticides wherever appropriate. And this step has raised certain concerns. So here our goal is to work with the agricultural community to make sure that neonicotinoids are used in a manner that minimizes the risk to pollinators while ensuring that products are available when they are needed. As I mentioned earlier, we acknowledge that these are very important tools required for the pest management. But here we want that they are used only when they are needed and they are used judiciously. So the MDA will work with the University of Minnesota and other stakeholders to develop pest thresholds and acceptable IPM criteria that should be used to justify a product application. And these requirements already exist on this label, especially for the neonicotinoid pesticides. So to justify the acceptable thresholds and IPM criteria, we would develop a formal process of verification of need by a trained and approved individual prior to the use of neonicotinoid pesticide on crops. So here our plan is that when the farmers are using the pesticide, they must document that there was a need for the use of that pesticide. And then we will ensure that the application of neonicotinoids are made only when a qualified individual verifies that there is a demonstrated pest problem and there is a need for neonicotinoid use. So here, we would be developing more detailed need-based guidance and IPM techniques for neonicotinoid use specific to Minnesota climate conditions. Currently on the labels, there is a wording that says that the IPM, there should be economic thresholds and IPM criteria that should be followed. But at this time, we do not know what that IPM criteria is. So we, in collaboration with the University of Minnesota and other stakeholders, we will define what that IPM is and what are the acceptable economic threshold periods. And when the economic threshold periods are developed, then we will educate the farmers to encourage the use of need-based guidance and IPM techniques. And then we will work to ensure that a qualified and informed person assists in decisions regarding neonicotinoid use. And we have not formally established the requirements for that qualified person. We will be working with the stakeholders, including the farmers and the registrants, the University of Minnesota researchers, and others involved to find out or to develop the requirements for the qualified person. That could be like, for example, extension educator from the University of Minnesota. They could be farmers himself. Those have a IPM training program. Those could be a pesticide applicator training license holder person that knows about the pollinators and also about the IPM. And then these requirements would be phased in over time as Minnesota-specific pest thresholds and similar need-based guidance becomes available. And so the verification of need prior to use does not apply to neonicotinoid-treated seeds. As I mentioned earlier, we do not have authority to manage the treated seeds. So the requirement for verification of need would apply only to the foliar application of neonicotinoid insecticides and also on the soil application of insecticides. The fourth step is to develop educational campaign for residential use of neonicotinoids. The steps further are self-explanatory. I would not be going into the details in favor of the time. So our fourth step is to develop educational campaign for residential use of neonicotinoids. The fifth action step is to review product labels for appropriate residential use of neonicotinoid. So our efforts won't be focused only on the agricultural use, but we will also be focusing on the residential use of neonicotinoids. And then we will develop Minnesota-specific pollinator stewardship material. That will be for insecticide-treated seeds, agricultural use of soil and foliar-applied neonicotinoids, and also for home and residential use of neonicotinoids. Our seventh action step is to increase use inspections for insecticides that are highly toxic to the pollinators, and that would include certain neonicotinoids. And our eighth action step is to review label requirements for individual neonicotinoid products. Here our goal is to ensure that label requirements for neonicotinoid products are appropriate for Minnesota-specific conditions. They're clear, unambiguous, and enforceable. Currently, there is a language on some of the labels that is relatively ambiguous. And so we will be defining that, what does that language mean? And then we will educate the farmers about the interpretation of that language. So these are our action steps. And now Whitney would talk about the pollinator summit that we carried out in February 2016.
Right, and to be clear, The Neonic report came out the same day as the executive order, which Crystal will be talking about. So prior to all of that, the MDA hosted a pollinator summit in collaboration with the Environmental Initiative. We tried to invite the full spectrum of interested stakeholders with the goal of kind of coming together around some broadly supported pollinator policies. Summit participants discussed different strategies and policies in small group conversations, and then at the end of the day, all of the participants were able to kind of vote on all of the ideas that came out of those small group discussions. Increased public participation in pollinator issues and interagency collaboration were two important themes that came out of the summit that are directly in the executive order. So for MDA's part in the executive order, our directives will be phased in over time. The department, as Raj has mentioned, will engage stakeholders throughout that process. And as Commissioner Fredrickson said in a legislative hearing last week, you know, the executive order really has set the table for the public process to occur in implementation of these directives that the governor has given our agency. We will be definitely working with farmers. There will be an education period for both farmers and pesticide applicators who use these chemicals. And moving forward, the department does intend to put two policies forward. We're going to request authority for the seed treatment program and the pollinator protection account, which were the two recommendations in the neonicotinoid review. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Crystal, who's going to talk more about the executive order as a whole.
All right. Well, thank you, Whitney and Raj. Nice job. My name is Crystal Boyd. I work for the DNR's Minnesota Biological Survey. We study rare things, rare plants and animals. Let me find my PowerPoint. Maybe a little technical assistance, but so I work for the Minnesota Biological Survey, and I'm also part of an interagency pollinator protection team. That's what we'll talk about today. On August 26th, the governor announced a new executive order at the Minnesota State Fair related to pollinators. So I will review the executive order, and then we'll talk about two teams that are going to come out of this. There's the governor's pollinator protection team, so kind of an external stakeholder team, and then the interagency pollinator protection team. That's someone from each of the agencies coming together to talk about state government on this issue. We'll also talk a little bit about the deliverables, what's going to come out of this executive order, and how are we going to measure our success? How do we know we did something? So our goals and metrics. And I'll wrap up with some neat little sidebars about interesting projects you might not have heard of yet. So this is the announcement at the Minnesota State Fair. As Whitney mentioned, the executive order came out on the same day as the neonicotinoid review that Raj just spoke about, and also on the same day as the review of the Pollinator Summit. So all those ideas that were pulled together by the public came out as a report, and all of those things came out together as a package at one time. One of the things the executive order asks for is this governor's committee, and I'm sure you guys have seen committees like this, right? These external stakeholders come together. It'll be a 15-member committee, and we're looking for people from a really broad range of backgrounds. We want a lot of good dialogue on this issue. So we're looking for people with a background in agriculture, conservation, education, academia, local government. People are really coming together on this issue, and so I think we'll get representatives from all of those backgrounds and have some great discussions. So that was the external team. The interagency team is represented by 11 agencies and the University of Minnesota, and each of these have phenomenal ways to tap into pollinators. It really is an issue that brings all of these stakeholders together. So these people will meet monthly or so on this issue. And we'll report back to you. So the Interagency Pollinator Protection Team will bring a report to you once a year. Our first report is due on December 1st. That's not very far away, so that's coming up pretty soon, December 1st, and it'll look similar to other reports you might have seen, like the Water Quality Report or the EQB Metrics Report. It's along those same lines, but on the topic of pollinators.
So to get ready for this, we had a results-based accountability workshop at the zoo where we had people from all these agencies come together, and we came up with a draft results statement. This is like our vision, what we're working towards. So it's very broad, high level. But we're looking for Minnesota will have healthy, diverse pollinator populations that sustain and enhance our economy, environment, and quality of life. We wanted to get all those pieces put together. So that's what we're working towards. And then we picked some more specific goals. Our first one is lands throughout Minnesota support healthy, diverse, and restored pollinator populations. So this is the goal. How are we going to measure it? We could do it a couple ways, and we haven't quite landed on exactly the right metric, but we're thinking about lands. You could do acreage in some form. So it could be state lands. These are a few agencies that have state lands they could be involved with. Or it could be private lands. So private property owners could get some education or some help from these agencies. Or we could do some combination of all of those. We could pull all that acreage together. We just have to figure out that number piece, but measuring lands. We're also interested in pollinators themselves. What is happening with some specific pollinator populations? That could be monarch butterflies from the University of Minnesota, could be honeybees from the U of M or the Department of Ag, native bees, that's part of my project with the DNR, or rare skippers. The DNR partners with the Minnesota Zoo to do a rare skipper project to track those populations. So lands or pollinator populations for the first one. Our second goal is Minnesota leads in researching, developing, and demonstrating ways to improve pollinator populations. And this is an amazing photo. This is some pollinator habitat that was installed on the Capitol grounds. You can see the Capitol in the background. You've got the pollinator right up front. It really shows what we're trying to do in Minnesota. And we want to share that with other states or other partners who might be interested. And I think there are some avenues to do that through the Department of Admin, and especially the EQB has pulled a lot of us together. The third one is really an outreach piece, which the MDA has already talked about a little bit. But we want Minnesotans to understand, value, and actively support pollinator populations. That action piece is really important. At the zoo, people emphasized it's good to be educated and value something, but we want them to take an action step to really show that they're involved and make some changes, some behavior changes. So here come a lot of logos because a lot of our agencies do outreach. And I apologize if I missed any agencies. A lot of people are working together on this. And the fourth goal, we're still drafting, but we wanted a statement that spoke to the economy, how do the different, the farming economy, the native plant supplier economy, the honeybee economy in Minnesota, how can we tie all of that together in a statement that supports what they do and still protects pollinators? So we're doing a little wordsmithing, but that'll come out soon. And to wrap up, I'll just mention a few initiatives that I never would have thought of. The Department of Health has been doing some groundwater enhancement in sensitive groundwater areas. They're thinking about replanting with native plants, and that can all be pollinator habitat. That's an overlap I wouldn't have seen if we didn't have the EQB pull these agencies together. The Pollution Control Agency at one of your meetings mentioned they might think about closed landfills as pollinator habitat. You can plant native plants on there. The Department of Admin, as we mentioned, planting at the state capitol, having pollinator habitat there both to support pollinators and educate the public. That's really a twofer. You get two benefits out of that one. And I like these last two a lot because I wouldn't have found them either. The Department of Corrections is very interested. They have some property that could become pollinator habitat. They're thinking about a honeybee program so their clients can learn how to raise honeybees and have a little bit of an income. And they also raise sage for Native American communities, and that could be another pollinator habitat opportunity. And then the Department of Education, they could do outreach at all of their libraries across Minnesota, little kiosks or museum displays about pollinators. So there are just really some neat collaborative opportunities that I think are going to come out of this. So that's a very high-level overview, but if you have any questions, we're happy to take them. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Lambert.
Mr. Chairman, maybe a couple questions for Raj that came up when he was talking about his presentation. The restriction on the use of neonics, the proposed restriction apparently applies only to the foliar or the soil application, you said, not to the seed application. Do you know what percentage of all neonics are non-seed that are used in Minnesota?
So as I mentioned, there are about 127,000 pounds of neonicotinoids being sold. And we do not have any record for the seed treatment, those being used on the seed treatment. Because we do not have the authority to manage that.
And I thought you said the application outside of seeds is already one of the labor requirements that you have it verified that it needs it?
Yes, for the foliar requirements, that requirement already exists on the label. That says that can be neonicotinoids can be used. First thing is neonicotinoids cannot be used when the bees are foraging or until all the flower petals has fallen. But neonicotinoids can be used under those conditions if certain conditions are met. And that condition include if the economic thresholds are met or there is a documented IPM program already existing. So at this time, we do not know what that IPM plan is or what are the economic thresholds for the pests. So our aim here is to follow the best science, to develop the economic thresholds. Those are specific to Minnesota. At this time, we do not have specific pest thresholds for all of the crops. We do have for soybean aphids, but there are several other pests for which we do not have. So we will work with the University of Minnesota first to develop a science. Once we have what the IPM plan can be, what the farmers can use under that IPM plan, and when we have all the economic thresholds established for most important pests, then we will educate the farmers about those, that these are the economic thresholds, those must be followed, and they must document before applying a neonicotinoid on as a foliar or soil application. And then only these restrictions would be included.
So presumably that, if the label says that there's some of that going on right now, but this will provide a verification of that by having a inspector come out.
Right. Okay. So we will define that, what the label means.
Okay. And second question, if I could, what's a bee icon?
So on the neonicotinoid pesticides, they have developed a pollinator box, and that has a picture of a bee that must be visible on the pesticide label. So any pesticide that has a bee label or the bee picture, bee icon, that is toxic to the pollinators, and those conditions must be met whenever that pesticide is being applied.
So that's the EPA's educational effort. Put a bee icon on there, and then you need to follow certain protocols. Okay.
Exactly.
All right, thank you.
Commissioner Stein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Raj, a question. You said in one of your actions would be consider having a seed treatment program at the state. Does any other state have such a program, or are they being developed elsewhere?
So there is no state that currently have that. There was a bill from Connecticut that wasn't passed. There was also a committee established by Vermont that may provide that would be, they would be working on that, and they should give their report by 2018. That may include some restrictions. Or they may have the authority, I won't use the word regulations, they may have the authority to manage the pesticide-treated seeds. So those are the only two states related to the seed treatments. But in addition, Maryland is another state that's not related to the seed, but they have restricted the use of neonicotinoids for homeowner consumers. So they have made the restricted use pesticides.
Thank you. And my second question was for Whitney. The summit that was held in February, just feedback from the people that participated from the agricultural community, what was their expectation? And I know the commissioner has been hearing some feedback from folks recently, and I'm just curious how the work on establishing advisory groups and drawing in agricultural business owners and also operators and communities from around the state is going.
Right. We have been getting a lot of feedback on this, as I'm sure you're all aware. As far as the Pollinator Summit goes, many agricultural entities were invited. The breakdown of the attendees, about 27% of our attendees were related to agriculture in some way. Some of the feedback that we've been getting is that, you know, people didn't necessarily know that this summit was, you know, going to result in an executive order, and people kind of thought that the report should have come out before the executive order. So we're working with stakeholders on some of those things, and as far as moving forward, certainly there will be agricultural representation on the governor's committee on pollinators. And we're working with the ag stakeholders to see, you know, what that looks like. And as, you know, Raj mentioned throughout the presentation, you know, the executive order was kind of setting the table, and now through implementation, we'll be working with stakeholders as well.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Question, John?
I attended the Interagency Pollinator Protection Group on Monday. Very well run, very interesting for me, enlightening. And I think you did a good job, Crystal, of, you know, at a high level, indicating what we did. But I do remember at that meeting, I promised you I would ask you a question, and I'm going to follow through with that.
I'm ready.
Okay. Goal number two, researching, developing, and demonstrating ways to improve pollinator populations. And this maybe goes back to what Raj covered under a dedicated pollinator protection account. Would some funds for researching come out of that account for research on pollinators, or is that specifically for neonicotinoids and insecticides?
That's a more of a policy matter. At this time, we will think that that could be related to any pesticides. Our aim would be, we will be initiating with the neonicotinoid pesticides, but our aim would be to eventually include the toxic pesticides, whichever could be toxic to the pollinators.
Okay, and I guess, Crystal, that didn't ask you a question.
That's okay.
But how about this? What's the next step before you give the report to us?
Sure, that's great. Our team will sort of distill what we talked about at the zoo and try to find all those right words. You know, it's hard with a large group to get all those words in the right spot, but we know what we want to do. So I think even though we have these goals, we need to find exactly the right words for the metrics and then pull together some of that data. So I think those are our next steps. And if Will has something
else. Yeah, and I'll piggyback onto that a little bit. There is a lot of work left to do. We tried to apply results-based accountability, right, which is an exercise in trying to find indicators that, you know, there's data power. We have the data. There's communications power. There's a narrative that you can tell. And there's proxy power. They represent a broader trend. And so it's I would almost characterize it as half science, half art. And so we still need to keep working on it a little bit with the interagency team over the next couple of weeks. The other big piece that will come out of it, though, is identifying what are those data gaps that we do need to continue to collect and what research needs to be proposed or programs need to be proposed to actually fill in that gap. So there will certainly be a lot of work that's happening across agency over the next couple of months, and we look forward to bringing this back to the board. While I have the microphone, just a couple other things I want to mention briefly before we move on. The first being the Governor's Committee on Pollinator Protection. That was announced and advertised on the Secretary of State's webpage after the executive order was rolled out. So that can be closed within 30 days. And so I'm encouraging you all and your agencies to help push and advertise this opening out to your constituencies that might be interested in participating, because we do want to ensure that there is a broad swath of interests that do get to have a voice in the discussion going forward. The other piece, too, I want to note is the interagency team. The genesis of it really, you know, I want to thank Commissioner Zelli, because back in January when we wrestled with this issue at the board, he was really helpful in convening the first meeting to really identify and gather the agencies at the table to start working on these issues across agency. But it's not complete. There are other agencies, and some not here, that have a stake in this. And so what's here in the order is not complete, and so if you have other colleagues that want a seat at the table and want to participate, it's an open invitation. So,
other questions, comments? Raj, I do have one question. You used the word residential. I'd like to know how pervasive the use of neonics on seeds are. So I believe the agricultural community is pretty well up to speed on this, but you take your individual urban gardener. Mm-hmm. What is the situation with seeds that you might buy at a garden store or something like that? Is there a refuge for bees within an urban area, or are those seeds treated as well?
So for the urban use, the seeds, the flower seeds and others are normally not treated with the pesticides. They are pesticide-free, but most of the use is on the flowering plants itself. So there are several plants. People are planting more, but there is a use as a foliar and soil application. But as far as the seeds are concerned, they are not normally treated.
So residential corn, tomato, whatever?
Yes, those are not treated.
Okay. Kristen?
Mr. Chair, hi. I had a quick couple questions about supporting the public in their activities, because I'm part of a new group that started in our River Valley, and the first forum they wanted to have, of course, was on pollinator protection. And the issue came up that someone had seen seeds or plants at Home Depot that were being sold with their pesticide packets attached. And they wanted to know, you know, what does that mean? Is that dangerous? Have you considered any kind of pesticide or neonic support or a call, what do you call those, hotline sort of thing? Have you considered anything like that to give?
I don't think we have a hotline at the department, but you can mm-hmm. certainly call us at any time if you ever have any questions about pesticides. We're the pesticide authority in this state. And we also do run a program, and I am not well versed in it, that certifies nursery plants. Do you know a lot about that program?
Oh, okay.
As pollinator friendly.
So our other division, the Division of Plant Protection, they have a program under which if the nurseries want to get their nurseries certified that they are using the neonicotinoid free plants, they can get it certified. At this time, there is only one nursery that has volunteered to get it to be certified, but the others are voluntarily avoiding the use of neonicotinoids, but they have not been certified by the department yet.
Oh, well, I would urge you to make those two resources more broadly known or known in a simple way, because there's so many questions out there. And I had one overlap question. I wondered if there has been any discussion of buffers in pollinator plants. Is there any piggybacking that has been discussed about buffers? I'm so excited about the highway department's wayside plan. It's so exciting. And I thought, well, why not buffers? So I wondered if there's anything.
The answer to your question is yes. Bowser's working on that.
Oh, great.
So when
great.
Conservation easements and that type of activities take place, yeah. There's recommended seed blends that would be pollinator friendly.
That's terrific. Thank you.
Other questions or comments? If not, thank you. Very informative.
Before
Raj,
I end, I have one last comment. As I mentioned, there have been a lot of news coverage on that the department is taking the neonicotinoids back. It would be banned. I just want to clarify for the audience also that the department does not intend to take the neonicotinoids back. We very well acknowledge that they are very important tools for the pest management, but we want them that they are used judiciously, and we are following the best science, and the farmers are educated, and we will promote that education. So that is the message I would like to give in the end. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you, Raj, Whitney, and Crystal. Very important subject and timely information. Okay, we will move on. The next agenda item is the Clean Power Plan, public engagement and input. And I would just remind individual in the audience, I do have two individuals that wish to comment on the Clean Power Plan. I will be calling for comments after the subject. So if you do wish to comment, please get a purple card that's available on the table end. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and board members. Thank you for having me here today. I'm Melissa Kusky. I work in the PCA's Air Policy Unit, and I'm the coordinator for the agency's Clean Power Plan work. I'm here today to talk to you about some of our engagement work we've done on the Clean Power Plan, what we've learned so far, and what may be needed in terms of broader interagency coordination in addressing some of that input. So it's just a quick overview of what I'll be talking about, just tell you a little bit about some of the engagement strategies we've been using, and then do kind of a deep dive on the listening sessions, which were kind of the big ticket item for some of the engagement work we've done on the Clean Power Plan to date, and then really jump into some questions to ask what's next and how you may all be involved. So we've been talking with stakeholders about the Clean Power Plan since it was proposed in the summer of 2014, and we continue to evolve in our engagement strategies as we go. And so one of the things we did last year was we tried to formalize our approach to engagement, and we put together a plan to really lay out what we're trying to accomplish. And from that plan, it's really kind of three key pieces. Number one, we're actually trying to learn about the Clean Power Plan with our stakeholders as we go. It's an incredibly complex regulatory item, and so it's taken a lot to even really understand exactly all the options we have before us. And so we're learning with our stakeholders. Number two is to actually meaningfully engage with our stakeholders. That means reaching people that we don't always reach in our regulatory work. And it means reaching them early enough to affect decision making. And it means really making an effort to understand their concerns as opposed to sort of defining what we want to talk about and making sure we're sharing that information with appropriate decision makers. And number three, also because we're required to, this is a Clean Air Act requirement that EPA has laid out. And so these are just some of the strategies that we've been using. We started with these technical stakeholder meetings where we were doing a really deep dive into the regulatory substance of the rule and discussing compliance options with a lot of stakeholders. And that's a group that has continued to evolve over time. And at this point, we have about 250 to 300 people getting notices of these technically focused meetings, but they are certainly open to everyone. And then we did the general stakeholder meetings, the listening sessions, and we plan to do more of those when we actually have some preferred proposals that we've decided on in the Clean Power Plan. And these are really conversations with citizens, not limited in scope necessarily by the regulatory steps, but kind of more citizen-driven. And then just a number of different other policies. We're trying to expand our online presence. We're trying to do more one-on-one engagement with different interest groups. And we're also trying to figure out how to engage and talk about an equity analysis that we plan to develop as an agency to support the Clean Power Plan work. And so our listening sessions, these are the general public focus meetings from the previous slide. These got a fair bit of press when we did them, in part because while they were scheduled before the Supreme Court stayed the rule, they were conducted immediately after, moments after. We learned 5 minutes before our first session that the rule had been stayed. And so it may have seemed a bit more provocative, but this has been a strategy we'd planned for some time that we needed to be out amongst the public. And so those were held in February and March of this year. We did 7 main sessions around the state. We also did a youth session in the Twin Cities. And so the structure of these was that we made ourselves available for about an hour before the session began to just do open house one-on-one conversations with citizens as they arrived. And then we did a presentation on what is the Clean Power Plan, what are we talking about. And then we really just shut up and listened. We answered questions when they were asked of us, but really it was a chance for citizens to give us their feedback and tell us what their biggest concerns were. In these sessions, they reached around 400 people around the state over the course of these two-month period. Some of the meetings had as many as 85 to 95 people, so it was really great turnout traveling around in all over the state in February and March. And so the reason we were out there really lines up with our general engagement goals that I described earlier, is to get the right input and get it early and learn about this together. And so this is something we were really committed to doing. So as people walked into the listening session, they were greeted with this enormous poster that we slogged across the state and shoved into a minivan. We gave people their dot stickers and said, here are your three dots. Let us know your top three priorities. And so some of the items on here you can't probably read is, you know, impact on your electricity bills, or reducing as much CO2 as possible, or growing green energy jobs. And so people, you know, gave us their feedback or wrote right on the poster if they didn't see their objective identified. And so this was a really nice way, first and foremost, to talk to people as they were coming into the room, and also to get a really quick snapshot of people's feelings before we even started talking. And so just from that dot poster, we called it Dotmocracy. I don't think we trademarked the term. These are the city by city, the listening session top priorities identified in each of the cities. And you can see different cities had different winners on the dot poster. We heard a lot about household rates in northern Minnesota. We heard about environmental protections in Duluth and Minneapolis, and clean energy in St. Paul. And we heard about preserving current energy sector jobs in St. Cloud. So a lot of different input from people coming into these meetings. And so this is kind of a screenshot from what's on our website right now. We took the Dotmocracy results, and we tallied them. And this is a compilation of the meetings we had these dot posters at through basically the spring. We've since used that poster even more. We use it at the state fair if you visited the Eco Experience. We actually had a rural electric co-op contacted us to use the survey format, and they sent it out to some of their members. And so we're still even counting dots that are still continuing to come in. And so this is all housed on our website, and you can kind of get a sense. You can click meeting by meeting results, or you can aggregate all the results and see how priorities change depending on who you're talking to. But we generally heard, you know, people want a meaningful plan that actually achieves some environmental protections and expands a green energy economy. But, it's a big but, don't forget about the effects on people's lives and their wallets and their jobs. And so this is a good set of direction to kind of understand where people are coming at the clean power plan from. But the meetings were a lot more than the dot poster. And this is really kind of the heart of why we were out there, was to hear from people. And this was what was in your packet. We tallied some of the key input, key themes from the meeting, and it kind of goes in these big five boxes. We heard, you know, on the environmental front, to maximize the CO2 reductions and move faster and recognize the costs of climate change and health impacts. On renewables and energy efficiency, we heard that people are really interested in Minnesota getting credit for a lot of the good work we've done already. And there's a lot of interest in looking at the cheapest, quickest opportunities that may exist in energy efficiency programs. We heard a lot of pushes for more community solar in the state, and just a general sense that we need to kind of innovate our way out of a climate crisis. On the compliance cost front, we heard a lot of input. People want to make sure we're remembering ratepayer impacts, and we're considering the costs of maintaining reliability of the electric system. And remember that if we're transitioning to a green energy economy, that means there are people in the current energy sector with good family-sustaining wages that may lose those jobs. And so don't forget about people as we're transitioning. But there's also a real sense of recognizing economic opportunities available in green energy and renewable energy, job growth especially. On the regulatory front, people encouraged us to be flexible and maintain a cost-effective approach, but to make sure that approach is still protective, that we're not, you know, creating new problems by moving quickly and overlooking, you know, potential problems, and make sure to coordinate both within the state and outside. And then a key bit of input is on the topic of environmental justice, that any clean power plan has to consider this, both in the effects of the pollution and also in the benefits that may be available as a result of a plan, and make sure that we're thinking about the effects of cap and trade at the community level. So obviously we heard some diverging opinions. We heard, you know, slow down, be more deliberate and thoughtful, and we heard speed up, we don't have enough time, we have to get moving on climate change. We heard that we need to consider the costs of acting and also the costs of inaction. And so that's something that we need to consider in these competing opinions, and we need to try and figure out how to balance this input that we've gotten from our stakeholders. But we did hear some areas of agreement. We heard thank you for being out and a hope that we'll continue to be out and about talking with people. We heard everyone agree that we need to be coordinating, especially with other states, because of the interstate nature of the energy system. So many Minnesotans get their power from power plants that are in North Dakota and South Dakota and other states. So we need to make sure that we're not just acting in a bubble and communicating with our other states. So basically, this summary, this key input is in your packet. But these sessions in general, they were wonderful. We heard some really thoughtful and compelling input from across the state, and it gave us a lot to consider when we start narrowing down plan options. But a lot of that input goes well beyond the confines of the Clean Power Plan and beyond the confines of the PCA's role as environmental regulator in the state, which is why I'm here to put these questions out to you. We were out around the state because of the Clean Power Plan, but people don't just want to talk to the PCA, and they don't just want to talk about the particulars of one specific Clean Air Act provision. The Clean Power Plan gets people talking, but they're talking about energy and climate change and health and the economy and job growth, most of which reaches well outside what we specifically focus on at the PCA. And so I'm sharing the input that we've heard to date to inform the work of the state generally and not just the PCA, and to ask this question: how is the state of Minnesota going to respond to the stakeholder input on clean energy planning, public health, energy sector jobs, ratepayer impacts, climate justice, and so on and so forth, given all the agencies working on these issues in different ways? And to kind of drill down on a really key topic that we heard in the sessions, we continue to hear as we continue to engage in the Clean Power Plan. Something that everyone really agreed on is that this area of equity, and we're also using the term climate justice, the input we've gotten from stakeholders is telling us this is beyond environmental justice. It's environmental justice. It's energy security. It's making sure people can actually afford to pay their energy bills. It's equal participation in a just economy that's very energy dependent. It doesn't start and end with the Clean Power Plan, and it goes well beyond that. We've had the chance to hear from Minnesota on this through the Clean Power Plan, but actually addressing it goes well beyond. And so we need to look at these three key points. Number one, making sure the development of the plan is informed by everyone. One public hearing in the middle of a workday on a rule that's largely already written isn't going to do it. We need to be out in communities and thinking about how we're getting the meaningful impact that we're really trying to seek. When we're talking about preventing disproportionate negative impacts, we're talking about pollution, certainly. Fortunately, the Clean Power Plan is something that reduces pollution, but it reduces it in the bigger scale. It reduces at the state and the national level, but we need to think about what's happening when we're shifting generation at the community level, which plants might be running more, which might be running less, and where are those plants located, and who's bearing the burden of potentially increased emissions. It's not just environmental, though. What if we see electric ratepayer increases? Nobody likes a higher energy bill, but when your energy bill is already 20 to 30% of your family's income, that's devastating. That means your kids may not have lights to do their homework, and you may not have air conditioning in the worst heat of the summer to keep your family safe. And so that's another kind of negative impact we need to be considering. And then on the flip side, making sure that all the opportunities that might be created are available to everyone. The energy efficiency programs that help reduce carbon emissions, they also help lower people's energy bills. Those are hard programs to do in low-income communities where you're dealing with usually older and potentially lower quality housing. It's hard to make efficiency ready. Or how do you do residential solar for a rental unit where the renter doesn't control their own rooftop? There's a lot of issues where we need to think about how do we deliver benefits equitably and ensure that any green jobs that are grown by this plan are hiring a racially and ethnically and economically diverse workforce. So that's a lot to digest. And again, the work to address these concerns goes beyond just the PCA because we're talking about energy planning and economic development and protecting public health. So I'm laying the question out to you: what's the first step? How do we start the conversation? I don't have answers. I'm hoping that just asking the question starts the conversation. But on the Clean Power Plan side, we're going to keep on talking to stakeholders and keep sharing what we've learned. But hopefully we're all going to commit to some sort of broader conversation to continue this work. So that's the end of my formal presentation. Thank you for having me, and I'm available for any questions.
Before we get into public comments, does any board member have any questions for Melissa? Commissioner Stein.
Just, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank Melissa and the staff of the agency that worked very hard to organize and prepare themselves for what was, I think, very difficult work. Having meetings sounds easy, but talking to people who come from very different perspectives, some who had their own narrative regarding what the Clean Power Plan was all about, mm-hmm. from varying different perspectives, and it's a very large state with very diverse people and economic circumstances, community circumstances, family circumstances. There's a lot of difference around the state. I really appreciate the sort of the effort to be equitable, to not try to find the thing that people, one thing, but many things. So I really appreciate that. That's hard work to organize and to develop the tools. So I thought that Dotmocracy was great because it does sort of engage people. I got a letter from a state senator asking me why in the world we would just let people vote with their dots. And if we were just going to count up the dots, and the dots were going to be the answer for the Clean Power Plan. Well, you know, you just saw what the answer for the Clean Power Plan in Minnesota would look like if we only used the dots. Now comes a really even harder work, and I ask you all to give it thoughtful consideration, how we can respond now. We have some time, but we don't have a lot of time to develop a plan for Minnesota. I think it's a very challenging task, and I'm hoping you're all willing to support our efforts in that and also bring people's perspectives to the discussion. So mostly, Melissa, thank you. Thank the staff and your group and all the agency personnel that traveled, the stakeholders that showed up. I mean, we had hundreds and hundreds of people participating, and I thought that was a phenomenal outcome.
Thank you.
Good job, Melissa.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments by board members?
I do have one. First of all, I want to applaud your process and your effort and the way the agencies and the follow-through you've done in giving us a report and really putting real questions from real people out there. I've not seen anything handled quite that well. And I'm really very impressed and grateful. And I've had a long time interest in in these questions that you're putting before us. And so I wanted to actually make a formal comment to the board, and I've got copies that I'll hand out. But I wanted to share a perspective from 20 years as a citizen advocate in the energy arena. I've primarily been involved on the ground in community organizing and community energy concerns, and long advocated the benefits of looking at our grid opportunities as a two-way grid and treating customers as investors and not just as consumers. I think this is one of the biggest pivot points we have right now, is to recognize the opportunities of our two-way grid and our two-way relationships as customers and energy producers. And individual and community scale investments in renewable energy production and efficiency provide significant services to the grid already in many parts of the country and here as well. And recognizing these customers as energy partners means that we have a whole nother pool of energy investors who are invested in investing in climate solutions. But they have to share in the benefits and share fairly. And major players, I've researched this for many years, major players in the industry see the implementation of a two-way grid with multiple players as central to the 21st energy economy. This is championed by EPRI, the foremost industry power research institute, the Galvin Institute, the Regulatory Assistance Project, which is a consulting firm of regulators who help states in policy and practice to support the implementation of a 21st energy system with a two-way grid in which customers are valued equally as energy partners and investors. But community players, and I know this from working in the area, face real limits of resources and power. And this happened in the Clean Power Plan in my attempts to participate and bring this forward in the technical part of the Clean Power Plan. They have to keep major investments focused on making things happen in the community and on the ground. And so how does this important element of a clean power business plan get and stay on the table? I submit to you that this is really a critical piece of our clean power plan, and I have attached to the testimony I'm going to hand out to the board two pages from NREL, National Renewable Energy Laboratory of the government, that talks about the community power isn't just a minor player in this game, that if we don't do our planning and our implementation from the top down and the bottom up, we're going to miss major opportunities and we're unlikely to meet our goals. So there's a huge, massive investment opportunity out there in the form of customer producers that's urgently needed to act on climate with the speed necessary, and particularly to the excellent question you brought to the table, particularly to contribute greater energy equity with economic opportunities for all, and particularly those who've been locked out of other wealth building and who are vulnerable to rate increases. So I submit to the board as I should probably be on the other side of this table right now, but that if energy equity is important to us, we need to support and make a place for these community and household level investors and investments in Minnesota's Clean Power Plan, or we will squander an unprecedented opportunity to include all of our neighbors in the economy, as Lieutenant Governor Smith has urged us to do. So the questions I leave us with as a board is, how can we do this? What is needed to capture the benefits and opportunities of redefining consumers as energy partners and investors in an equitable energy future? And the question that you asked, what can EQB offer in terms of helping to put and keep this wider set of opportunities for all of Minnesotans on the table? Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Kristen. And you do have those comments to share with the board,
I do.
Correct?
Mm-hmm.
Those will be passed out.
Yeah.
Any other comments prior to moving on to testimony? Okay, I've got three individuals that have passed in cards indicating they'd like to speak with the board. I'd like to invite up, I believe the first two are going to do a joint presentation, George Crocker and Timothy Denharder Thomas. And prior to getting started, I'd just like to remind commenters that we do have two agenda items left, and we do have a number of individuals that wish to comment on the Line 3 project, and we've got about an hour and a half left, so please be respectful of everybody's time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is George Crocker. We do appreciate your time this afternoon. I'm the executive director of the North American Water Office that's been involved with these issues for quite a long time. I'm also on the board of Community Power, which is, we did have a handout, Mr. Chairman, that that you have. Maybe you could distribute that to the, yes, okay, fine. So Community Power was instrumental in bringing forward the nation's first city utility partnership between the city of Minneapolis and the utilities that serve gas and electric, Xcel and CenterPoint. This city utility partnership has received attention from the White House as well as from the Pope in Rome, where Mayor Hodges took a trip earlier this year to talk about this innovation. So we think we have something to offer in terms of the lens that you can be looking through in terms of how to accomplish this. Now, we had our first societal discussion about these issues in the wake of the Arab oil embargo a long time ago. And you can fast forward to now, even though in the wake of that, we passed a law that says Minnesota has a vital interest in conservation and renewable energy, we still, 20 years later, had virtually the same mix. And now the only reason that that mix has changed is because of the big fight we had over nuclear waste 20 years ago. The reason this is so hard, and you have to understand this, is because the tendency of the utility managers and regulators is to protect the sunk investment. That is what their job is. And unless we can figure out how to overcome that tendency to protect the sunk investment, we will continue with the polluting machines, and we will continue rewarding that pollution. So I have two sort of examples of how we can start to look at this thing through a lens that really does focus market forces. So we bring into the whole challenge of this, what are the costs? And we don't be raising rates to do this. If you look at what we have right now in the electric utility industry, we have wholesale competition, and it's based on price, and the price is determined by a localized marginal price of power, which is usually somewhere in the 4 to 5 to 7 cent range. Meanwhile, we have PURPA, the Public Utilities Regulatory Policy Act, which requires utilities to purchase electricity from qualifying facilities, but only at what the utility says its avoided cost is, which is usually less than 2 cents. Can't cash flow, we don't get PURPA machines. Okay, if we have wholesale competition for the big players, why can't we have an avoided cost tariff under PURPA that brings some equity to the price that utilities have to put on the table, the real cost of power? So that's one example. The other example, just quickly, is that we still reward the pollution. We have a pollution problem because we make people more financially healthy as they produce more pollution. The utility earnings are tied to the sale of their commodity, not the efficient use of it. We can change that, and you can change that quickly. We know how to do this if we overcome that inertia that's set up to protect the sunk investment. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak. My name is Timothy Denner-Thomas. I'm the general manager of Cooperative Energy Futures, which is an energy co-op that is developing community solar gardens and energy efficiency and residential solar opportunities with a big focus on equity. I'm also, along with George, on the board of Community Power, which is a coalition of organizations working on these issues. And I wanted to take a little bit of a step back and, you know, first of all, really appreciate the work that the EQB is doing to evaluate the Clean Power Plan and this overall energy transition in a very comprehensive way, and specifically to talk about equity and to support the existing work around the equity analysis. And really to offer a lens of how to think about equity around this whole energy transition and the shift around where we need to go with climate change. I think a lot of the time in energy spaces, equity gets talked about first and foremost as an issue of rates, and that is essential. That's a key piece of it. From all my work organizing in the Twin Cities and with various coalition partners around Minnesota, rates is only part of the cost equation. The other part is how much energy are people using. And what I've seen time and time again is that low-income people, small businesses that are, you know, right near that break-even point, renters rarely have access to the same opportunities to shift how much energy they use that wealthier families and larger businesses do. So whereas we might have equity or at least a process for trying to get to equity on the rates, we're not ensuring equity on access to energy efficiency and other opportunities that can give people the power to change their actual cost. I think many people have brought up during the Clean Power Plan process the importance of the health and environmental costs and how do we make sure that that's not being concentrated in low-income communities and communities of color. The other piece, and a big piece of what George has talked about and the two opportunities that I'll mention, is what is the equitable allocation of the benefits? How are we ensuring that the environmental benefits, but also the revenue that's coming out of energy efficiency improvements, renewable energy improvements, all these other innovative technologies, how are we ensuring that that revenue and that ownership is shared and is accessible to everyone? That's been a core of the work that I've been doing in a cooperative and really what I need to go, what I think we need to go towards. Two strategies I'll just quickly bring up, and these are outlined along with what George mentioned in this handout. The first is a model that's been called pay-as-you-save around the country. It's a model for tariff-based inclusive financing for efficiency and renewable energy projects, where you basically attach the repayment of those measures to the energy bill so that month by month, the amount that a resident or a small business or an organization is paying is less than the actual energy savings that's delivered. So this is a way to have zero upfront cost and zero net monthly cost implementation of these energy improvements for residents and commercial entities. This has been done in several other states and local communities around the country, and they've seen factor five or even higher increases in the rate of uptake because they're allowing people to do this with no personal debt. I think this is a strategy that's really important to consider. And we've been working with Holmes Hummel, who's a former advisor to the Department of Energy, to do a series of trainings for people across Minnesota on this issue, and also to help us do a feasibility study of what it would look like to bring this model to Minnesota. We'd be really interested in partnering with agencies in the EQB to look at what would it take to do that analysis, really show what it looks like to implement this program here. The second thing I'll mention is accessible community solar. You've probably all heard a lot about solar gardens and the challenges with making sure that residents and particularly low-income people have access to it. And I could spend a long time talking about the specific things I've done in my co-op to create solar that's targeting low-income people. But I think a really key opportunity that's coming up right now is the Department of Commerce is charged with evaluating potential adders to the value of solar for residents, low-income people, various other criteria of what solar gardens could look like. That's due by March 1st, and I think it's really important to expand that question, simply beyond what value of solar has traditionally been defined as the value of solar to the utilities, and look at the value of solar to all participants in society in the context of the Clean Power Plan and all of these climate regulations that are going on. And so we'd really appreciate help from the EQB and the agencies involved to make sure that that process is really comprehensive and looking at the factors that apply to all those different concerns. So we have this three-pager. We'd be happy to talk in more detail about these ideas. There's also a lot of other opportunities that we think are on the table. We just wanted to highlight these four as a core. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, George, Timothy. Very informative, and thank you for the preparation of this information.
Thank you.
Our next speaker is Mayar Sorar. Can I get a little closer this time?
So thank you, Vice Chair and members of the board. My name is Mahiar Saru, the environmental justice organizer with MPERG, and I just wanted to provide comments on Melissa's presentation and really just want to start off to first, thank Melissa and the Clean Power Plan MPCA team, and especially the environmental justice team, on their work with really engaging communities on this their Clean Power Plan state implementation plan. But as usual, as there is always progress, there is always necessary for those to continue to make comments to really further that progress in the right direction. So I kind of just wanted to make a note on one of the aspects that the MPCA has been conducting this engagement. Has been a recent survey that has been developed online that highlighted different pieces similar to the Dotmocracy that they performed, but there were similar aspects of the web page survey that I really wanted to comment on sort of the absence of the word equity in that piece that was submitted to the general public. Having a piece on equity included in these survey questions gives opportunities for vulnerable and overburdened communities to feel like their concerns are still looked at the forefront of these Clean Power Plan conversations. Especially, as most often than not, as we've seen by the MPCA's presentation, vulnerable, low-income communities of color are those that face the greatest impact of climate change, not only towards their health and, of course, the economic impacts of as we're making this transition. And so I really just wanted to just make a comment on the fact that, conversations about equity, while we obviously saw they were included in the presentation, that was awesome. Having even a piece on equity so folks can see that these communities are also looked at as stakeholders in the final plan and in the final process of this state plan. And so with these conversations, I know Melissa mentioned that, you know, they have been having stakeholder meetings on the Clean Power Plan and this engagement, as essentially the MPCA is learning more about the Clean Power Plan with these stakeholders. I wanted to comment that, you know, I've been to a lot of these stakeholder meetings. They are during the day and don't really give a chance for many environmental justice organizations or just community leaders to feel like they are also sort of moving along in this process the same way that maybe some of the more, you know, bigger environmental organizations or even utility companies are learning about this process. I've been to many conversations and panels where they've had a set of panels that have included utility leaders like Xcel Energy, but I have yet to see anything including organizations like Energy Cooperative that really highlight and like talk about those aspects that Timothy and sorry, I forgot the other gentleman's name, talked about in terms of like community solar opportunities. And again, as we're making this transition to a green economy, how are we doing it without pitting the jobs piece and the environmental piece against one another, and how we're doing it in an affordable way? I just wanted to highlight on that. But again, I really do appreciate the presentation and the conversations about environmental justice. It's very, very nice to see. And I also just wanted to highlight on the Department of Health and DEED, we really need you all, too, in these conversations. As we're moving towards this just transition, we need the jobs piece and we need the health piece to be working with the MPCA to be able to really implement a strong and just plan here in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have one final commenter, Ann Ellis, who is joining us from Baudette, which is about as far away from here as you can get and stay in Minnesota.
That is true. Hello, everybody.
Good afternoon.
Thank you very much. I wasn't planning on speaking, but since I was here and you're willing to listen, I represent North Star Electric Cooperative in Baudette, Minnesota, on the Canadian border. I want to thank Melissa for coming to Bemidji State University so that we could listen to what was going on. It was interesting to listen to, but when I went home, I thought, what do our members think? Do they think the same as the people in Bemidji or the people in the Twin Cities? So we are the co-op that did the Dotmocracy survey, Bill Stuffer. And what we found out is that 36% of the Dots landed on concern about their residential electric bill. And so I just want to talk a little bit about, it is a very complex issue, especially when electricity, it's not like energy in a pipeline where if you're not using it, it just sits there. If it's generated, it has to be used at the moment it's generated, unless there's storage. And that is something that, well, Tesla's working on it. Lots of people are working on it, but it's not there yet. And so in the meantime, if there's an abundance of energy being put on the grid, you know what happens when you have an overloaded circuit at home. You got to do something about it. Same thing. If there's nothing running at the time, there's no electricity to light your home. So I appreciate the fact, and I know David Thornton at one of our meetings mentioned how complex it has, you know, become. He's become aware of as you dig into the weeds. So please be aware of that. So anyway, North Star and the Minn Kota co-ops in northwest Minnesota were very early adopters of a significant amount of wind energy, and that was about 8 years ago. And I think that our members put their dots on the price of their electric bill because they're already paying for significant wind investment. And so soon we will have 43% of our capacity coming from wind and hydro. 9% of that is hydro. But of course that came at a cost, and they've seen their electricity bills rise. The wholesale cost of power has doubled in less than 10 years. So what we're concerned about is now the Clean Power Plan's come along, and as you probably all know, that all of the cooperative electricity across the entire state comes from outside the boundaries of Minnesota. And so we're going to have to comply with the state where our electricity is generated. In our case, it'll be North Dakota and 45%. So we're going to have to deal with the cost associated with that compliance. What I want you to know is that if North Star and all the other co-ops have to also comply with Minnesota mandates or whatever you come up with, that that will hit our customers, our members, our member owners a third time. So I'm just asking for, you know, your cognizance of the impact of the cost and how that's impacting our folks way up north. So thank you for listening.
Thank you, Ann. And oh, Commissioner Stein, go ahead.
I just want to thank you for making the trip. I know we met and were able to talk about these issues just briefly in a hallway conversation, but I do want, you know, to encourage you and all of us to think about how we then, in presenting our plan, might mitigate the issues that you're addressing. Now, there are all of the investments that are already made. I think we have to have a thoughtful plan looking forward about how we continue to honor investments while we transition. So I think that's going to be the art of designing a good clean power plan. I certainly want to talk to my colleagues in North Dakota about their plans and their ideas so that our input of members in Minnesota, the co-op members in Minnesota, can be heard. So thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Second that. And just for clarification, our Dotmocracy exercise segmented business rates and residential rates. Mm-hmm. You had said 36% of yours were residential. Is that a combination?
No, that is not. The number two concern was 18% of the dots landed on minimized regulatory requirements. 10% was increasing use of solar, wind, etc. Then preserving current energy sector jobs, and then impact on electric bills for businesses at 7%.
Okay.
I can leave this for you if you'd like.
If you would, that'd be nice.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, you can bring it up. That concludes the individuals that were interested in testifying regarding a clean power plan, unless I'm mistaken. All the rest of the individuals who wish to testify, which appears to be about six, will be discussing line three. So we will move on to the next agenda item. And the next agenda item is the Incorporating Climate Change with Environmental Review presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the board. My name is Mark Riegel. I'm a planner with the EQB Environments Review Program. And here with me is Sam Rademacher, who is an undergraduate student at the University of Minnesota and who also interned with the EQB Environments Review Program this past summer.
Nice to have you both here.
Thank you. And Sam's going to be doing most of the presentation, and she'll have time to do more of an introduction later. But first, I wanted to give you some background on the EQB internship and some of the work that we asked Sam to accomplish this past summer. So for a number of years now, the EQB has had a relationship with a University of Minnesota Environmental Review class that has studied environmental review at both the state and federal level. So each spring, EQB staff present to the class and talk about the Environmental Quality Board's role in implementing the Minnesota Environmental Review Program. And then following that presentation, a student from the class then joins the EQB team for a summer internship. So this past year, EQB staff presented to the class in April, and Sam joined us in May to complete a summer internship. So previously, EQB interns have focused on making updates to environmental review guidance documents. But this year, given the board's interest in the topic of climate change and environmental review, we thought it'd be a great opportunity for Sam to do policy research and look into this issue. So more specifically, we asked Sam to compile, I'll go to this. We asked Sam to compile information on what is being done at both the federal and state level to begin incorporating climate change into environmental review. And then using this information in some of these examples, start to think about what opportunities are available for the Environmental Quality Board to consider this issue. So all of this research culminated in a final summary report, which is included in your board packet, and Sam will discuss in more length, which we're really looking at this as a first information gathering and starting point for future conversations on the topic of climate change and greenhouse gas emissions analysis within the environmental review process. So with that, I'll pass it over to Sam, and she will do the rest of the presentation.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the board, as Mark said, my name is Samantha Rademacher. I am an undergraduate student from the University of Minnesota. I'm entering my fourth and final year in my program, which is Environmental Sciences, Policy, and Management. And as Mark also said, I have just prepared for you kind of a condensed version of what's in this document, which should be in your board packet. And with that, I just really want to begin by laying the foundation, kind of going a little back in time to talk about NEPA, or the National Environmental Policy Act. NEPA was enacted in 1969 by the United States Congress as a response to public concern for environmental quality. And really, it just intended to accomplish three very large goals. First, to promote environmental health in order to reduce damage on the environment. Secondly, to enrich knowledge of natural resources at a national level. And lastly, to establish the Council of Environmental Quality, much like the Environmental Quality Board, is responsible for overseeing the environmental review process at a federal level. And the deliverables of this act are encapsulated really in two documents. This is the Environmental Impact Statement and the Environmental Assessment. Again, very similar documents to what we use here in Minnesota. And what these documents really allow us to do at a federal level and state is to ask targeted questions to assess how a proposed action may impact the environment. And so the Council of Environmental Quality has direct influence over the content of these documents in asking these pointed questions. And their main goal is to continue developing tools to improve and modernize NEPA. And they've started to realize that the one thing missing at present time is the idea of climate change consideration in these documents. So what they've done, beginning in 2010, is they released a guidance document to help federal agencies better assess or incorporate climate change into the environmental review process. They later updated this document in 2014. The major change there was just in extending this document to apply to all federal actions, including land and resource management departments. And just recently, in August of 2016, the finalized guidance document has been published. I would just like to note that the remainder of my presentation and the entirety of my document is actually based off the 2014 revised document because I completed my internship in late June before the document was released. Sad timing, but that is where we're at. And one of the really important themes that came out of this 2014 guidance document is the idea that the CEQ is going to have their agencies consider both mitigation and adaptation strategies. They are going to consider how to mitigate the impact of a proposed action in regards to climate change and also how to adapt in the face of the challenges we are faced with from these climate change, from how the climate is changing in the future. Sorry. And that's just kind of a high-level look at what we have been doing at the federal level. And I want to show how that has influenced the implementation at a state level. This is often called a State Environmental Policy Act, or a SEPA. It is independent from the federal process. It is not overseen or controlled by the federal government, but influenced and implemented individually at the state level. And so I'm just going to go through very briefly and highlight who is following NEPA and how in which they are doing it. There are 28 states which have NEPA-like impact statement procedures. Only 16 states in the U.S. have fully developed acts, and those are the states highlighted in blue here. It may be difficult to see, but Hawaii and the District of Columbia are included in this graphic. And these acts have been adopted as early as 1970, just a year or even a few months after it was established at a federal level, and as recently as 1991. And really, I just want to take time to provide a picture of how each state has taken their own approach to implementing this at their own level. And I'm going to try and highlight states that have tried to incorporate climate change into their environmental review process just to give you all an idea of what this might look like if Minnesota was to follow a similar path. I am going to start with Massachusetts and California, These are two states which have made targeted language changes to their environmental review documents. Massachusetts saw the opportunity to reduce greenhouse gas emissions at the state level, and in doing that, they used their environmental review program documents as a vehicle to address these issues. So there's direct language, and it may be difficult to see, but this is a screenshot of their environmental notification form from Massachusetts, and it's asking very specific language for the document preparer to consider greenhouse gas emissions when looking at how a proposed action may impact the environment. This is one example of a state that has made actual language changes. Next, California was the very first state to follow the federal example. They implemented their SEPA in 1970, and they've made a progression of acknowledging the fact that they also would like to reduce greenhouse gas emissions at the state level. Starting in 2006, they simply acknowledged, we would like to reduce greenhouse gas emissions at the state level. The following year, they figured their environmental review process was the perfect vehicle to start addressing the projects which may contribute to greenhouse gas emissions. And finally, the Governor's Office of Planning Research was charged with developing a technical advisor, which was very unique to California. They provided a guidance document, much like the CEQ has done, providing information for local and state agencies within California to make these targeted changes and to address climate change within their processes as they prepare these documents. And so these are two examples of targeted language changes. And then next, I will highlight Hawaii and Washington. Hawaii is unique in that they are an island environment. They have different concerns than many of our other states. Simply, they're, you know, more exposed to the ocean than the rest of us. They are more concerned about rising ocean levels, and they have different environmentally sensitive areas just because it is an island, which is a different can of worms we can talk about later. but Hawaii has chosen to localize their environmental review process where they have comprehensive plans at the county level, or each island is considered a county, and each county has prepared this comprehensive plan. If a proposed action is in compliance with this plan, it will forego the process. It does not need to undergo any further environmental review unless it is located in a predetermined environmental sensitive area. This is really similar to what we do in Minnesota with the AUAR, the Alternative Urban Area Wide Review process, and that's just a snapshot of our processes in Minnesota, just to draw that connection. But it's very similar and something that Minnesota might look into if we were to consider following a path such as modernizing our program. Although they've made these changes, they have only recognized climate change as a concern in the state of 2012. They have not made specific language changes to their review documents. Washington, they, another example of a state who has not made specific changes to their documents, but they have acknowledged that they have a growing population and strain on their resources, and they wish to use their environmental review process to address these issues. They're again using that as a vehicle to address major projects within the state. And the product of this is the environmental checklist, which, just to summarize, as I said before, has no specific language changes. So you can kind of see there is a difference between Massachusetts, California, and Hawaii and Washington, states in which have made specific language targets and states which have not but have produced significant ideas establishing they would like to modernize their process. Now, I've kind of given, if you find yourself wanting more detail about these states, I direct you to my document. Page 5 is where there's more summaries on these states. And page 11, there is Appendix A, which I have prepared just kind of as a one-stop shop resource for each of those 16 states that is included and which follow NEPA. Just going through it very quickly, I've provided the state and the agency which is responsible. For example, you would see Minnesota Environmental Quality Board, and there is a link providing information to their site department. Just some context in which they enacted their SEPA, just to let you know, did they follow the federal example quickly, or did they take some time to kind of get to where they are now, and what their act is called in case you have specific questions about their languages. I moved on to legislative and executive actions the state has taken in order to modernize their process. Not every state has something filled in here. Some do, some do not. As you can see, Georgia has a SEPA enacted. They have not done much with it since 1991. So there is a difference. Just because you are one of these 16 states that has made tons of progress in implementing the SEPA program, it does not mean you are one of the states that is forward-thinking enough to put your energy into really addressing current-day issues. And with that, I want to really move into what we're doing in Minnesota, what the authorities of the Environmental Quality Board are as of today over our environmental review documents and kind of the opportunities we have to make changes. So in 1973, Minnesota Environmental Policy Act was adopted, and it's very important to note that as the EQB, as outlined in Minnesota Rules 4410, 0400, subpart 1, we are charged with two major jobs. The first of which is to ensure the effectiveness of the environmental review process and address the shortcomings of the process. We are currently responsible for measuring effectiveness in whichever way that is necessary and to take action to improve. And whether that be through modernizing NEPA or not, that is just something that is up to the EQB to make a decision on. The deliverables of the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act, much like the federal government, is the environmental assessment worksheet, the environmental impact statement, and the alternative urban area-wide review. Just at a very high level, we control the content of the environmental assessment worksheet, which accompanies an environmental impact statement process, which directly influences an alternative urban area-wide review. And that last process is just, if there are several proposed actions within a geographic area, for example, building a retirement home and a coffee shop and a grocery store all in the same block, those can kind of be condensed into one process, but it's individualized is where the environmental assessment worksheet is tailored to that project. But having influence over the content of the EAW will influence the rest of our deliverables. And I just want to highlight those three main points, three main takeaways from this presentation today, that there are resources available both at the federal and state level for us to make or even consider making a decision on this issue. There is no really wrong or right way to approach it. As I've said, there's several states. Each has taken their own individualized approach to modernizing their processes. And lastly, I believe we have very similar opportunities in Minnesota as they do in Massachusetts or California or Hawaii or Washington. We have very similar opportunities to go forth and modernize our process, and we could be one of the very first states in the U.S. to kind of pave the way and show what it looks like to consider climate change on a very serious level at quantitative and qualitative levels. And with that, I close my presentation. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Questions? Commissioner Rothman.
Sam, first of all, let me applaud and commend you for, as an undergraduate, working on this and doing an amazing job. It's really terrific. So now, if you were to, if I were to give you a magic wand, and you talked about the opportunity and, you know, Minnesota can lead and all that, what would you specifically suggest that the board, EQB, do next with the report? In terms of implementing or specific suggestions?
Mr. Chair and members of the board, in my own personal opinion, what I would see the next steps of this process being are taking all the agencies, even all of you before me, and deciding what we want Minnesota to look like in terms of preserving our natural resources and conserving what we have in this state. It's very important to define what we want quantitatively and then decide how we're going to get it. And whether that be through adding specific language to this process or not, I think it's just important that we consider that the option is there, the challenges are before us, and we have the opportunity to make the change. Thank you.
Answer? Will, did you have something?
I was just going to ask you what your plan. Well, first, thank you for your hard work, Sam, but just ask you what your plans are after you graduate, if you're thinking that far ahead.
Man, I wish. Is anyone hiring? I'm just kidding. No, I actually, Mr. Chair, members of the board, I do have some tentative plans to leave the state and move abroad for the very first time, try my hand at learning Italian. But I'm not exactly sure in what context. Maybe it'll just be for fun. We'll see what happens. I would like to kind of follow the resource conservation path, though. I'm very interested in addressing climate change, especially in peatlands. I'm really into soils right now. Somehow finding a way when I come back or even abroad to, like, combine my interest for climate change and the ways in which we interpret that, that would be my ideal job.
I'm sure you will be successful in that.
Thank you.
Did you notice in your research of the other states? We all know Minnesota leads, but in terms of second place, what would you say were the more innovative states out of those 12?
Mr. Chair, if I had to pick someone who I think had been the most forward-thinking state, it would be definitely between Massachusetts and California, those two states I first highlighted, mostly because they are some of the first states to make these changes, and they've made very good progress. They've done what the federal government couldn't do, and they've quantitatively decided what they want. They've decided thresholds of significance in some cases. They've decided what they want in terms of emissions, and I think that that's something that a lot of states struggle with. The U.S. government struggles with is putting a number, not just saying we would like to make these changes, but really quantifying them and making a decisive plan. So it would be very difficult to decide, but between Massachusetts and California, they're very forward-thinking.
Well, you've already taken 10 plans out of off our reading list, so that helps a lot. Any other questions, John?
Samantha, you mentioned California and Massachusetts, that in their environmental review process, they address climate change, and you speak highly of them. Can you give us an idea what kind of impact that has on their environmental review process and in terms of its efficiency or timelines, things like that?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, if I had been given more time in my research, I would have loved to contact the representatives of these agencies, and part of the appendix that I mentioned, these are links to their contact information. So that was something that was discussed when I worked with Mark and Courtney, but something that never was able to happen. I would love to know how efficient or how they feel as document preparers or RGUs, what their takeaways from that are, and if they really actually enjoy the process or if they think it's not as helpful as it all sounds. That'd be something interesting to look forward to in the future.
Thank you.
Other questions?
And Mr. Chair, I would just also add that Sam's done some great work in pulling together this summary report. And what we're EQB staff are looking at doing is updating the report to reflect the most recently released final guidance on incorporating greenhouse gas emissions and climate change analysis into environmental review. And then also just really looking at this report as a starting point for future conversations. So it's really just pulling together all of this information. And now that it's there, we can start thinking about what would be the best next steps or what information you'll seek out next.
Commissioner Stein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mark, yes, you skated by pretty unscathed in this presentation. So now that you said that, I would like to hear more about what's going on in other states, and I think we should develop some options. I would really appreciate it if the staff could prepare some scenarios that would address climate change in a meaningful way in the context of an environmental assessment worksheet. It seems like the most rational place to begin. It's the kind of a document that the most projects are subject to completion, and it would be useful for us, I think, to answer the question that Mr. Saxog just asked, which is, what would it look like if we were to put in the effort to scope this question of climate change? How much effort would it require of a project sponsor, of an RGU, and how much value then would we put on, you know, understanding that information? So that's what I would ask the staff to, again, within the constraints of the existing resources, put that on our plate.
Thank you.
I think that's a good suggestion. As Sam pointed out, we have control of the content, and that would go directly to threshold as well, depending upon how we treat content. And I think they really go hand in hand.
Yep.
Other comments?
Well, yeah, and I'll just jump into this question has been posed to us a little bit, and some comments we've received in our current rulemaking docket. So to be continued. I mean, we'll certainly report back to the board as we do further research on this, but we can certainly get back to you, Commissioner, on that question. And this is the third year we've had this partnership with the university. I think it's a really valuable opportunity to to talk to students who are learning environment review more broadly and studying at the university, but also provide them an opportunity to see how state agencies work and hopefully create long-term relationships. So thank you. And just a note, a fun fact about Mark Riegel. So the state agency 5K last week, he was the second fastest state agency employee. So I think he runs like a 30-second mile.
Yeah. Better come up to Grandma's. All right, thank you. Very informative presentation. Sam, good luck in your studies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, that brings us to our final agenda item, which is an update of the environmental review of North Dakota Pipeline Company, LLC's proposed Sandpiper Pipeline, and Enbridge Energy's Limited Partnership's proposed Line 3 replacement. And I see Barb, I don't see Bill, but I see Michelle, so please come.
Yeah.
Is Bill here?
Bill's not here, so it's...
Okay.
But we do have someone from the Commerce Department here, yes.
He's the same haircut as Bill does.
That's right.
About the same height as well.
Is your mic, go ahead, and please introduce yourselves for the record.
Good afternoon, Curtis Zahn.
Good afternoon, Curtis Zahn, Assistant Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and I'm here on behalf of Deputy Commissioner Bill Grant, who regrets he was unable to attend because of scheduling conflict.
Barb Narramore, Assistant Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources.
And Michelle Beeman, the Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Welcome, and thank you for being here.
Well, we're here to update you on kind of the status of Sandpiper and Line 3. So first, we'd like to start with the fact that Enbridge has submitted a request to withdraw its Sandpiper application to the PUC, and that Commerce, PCA, DNR continue to move forward on the EIS for the Line 3 replacement. And the Line 3 replacement proposal is to replace an existing crude oil pipeline that originates in Alberta, Canada, and terminates in Superior, Wisconsin. The current alignment of Line 3 follows the Enbridge main line, but Enbridge has proposed to relocate the Line 3 replacement following the proposed Sandpiper route. The scoping decision documents should be filed today. That's where we're at. They're currently scurrying to get them done, but they will be filed today. And in that, you'll notice that agencies propose to study alternative routes as well as truck, rail, and no-build alternatives. We expect the PUC to act on both the Sandpiper withdrawal and the draft scoping decision document sometime in late October. After the PUC has issued an order approving the scoping decision documents, Commerce will publish a notice of EIS preparation in the State Register, which starts the 280-day statutory deadline. In the meantime, Commerce continues to conduct outreach to stakeholders, tribal governments, and obviously other agencies, DNR and PCA, and will continue to do so throughout the EIS preparation process. So that's kind of where we're at today. If there are any questions?
Questions by the board?
Is that the final, Mr. Chair, final presentation, or do we have something more there?
I mean, well, there are individuals that are going to be coming up giving us more, but so, citizens, agency. Not agency personnel.
I see.
Mr. Chair, if the board would like, Deputy Commissioner Beeman and I might provide just a brief update on some of the additional work that the agencies have been doing with some of the citizen groups that appeared before you my memory fails, but a couple, three meetings back mm-hmm. and expressed some concerns about process and so forth. Would that be helpful?
Sure.
Yes.
I'll take the first stab at that. So Deputy Commissioner Grant, Deputy Commissioner Beeman, and I were able to meet with representatives of several groups back in early August. It was a really very helpful conversation in which we had an opportunity to hear at a more detailed level some of the kinds of concerns and ideas that folks had brought before the board. And I would say in summary, some of the major points, at least that I took away, a lot of concerns and questions around the environmental review process, which is something, as an environmental review agency, we hear and experience at DNR on a number of our more complex project proposals. And so, you know, people, I think it's fair to say, find the process somewhat confusing and opaque at times. They're not always sure how and when they're able to engage effectively in the process, really want a process that provides them with a two-way communication opportunity with the agencies so that they are both informed about the proposed project and have an opportunity to provide meaningful and timely input to the environmental review agency, or in this case agencies, about the project. We heard some very specific comments or concerns also around the openness and the transparency of the process. So, you know, how and when is information made available, and are there some ways, some techniques we might employ to improve people's access to the information and also their understanding of it. Some of this information is highly technical, and yet people want to understand its practical implications. And so we had a lot of discussion around that. And then finally, some really very helpful conversation about how there's two things in combination, the kind of process questions and then the questions around openness and transparency and access to information combine to leave people uncertain at points about the, scientific and procedural integrity of the process. If they don't understand it, they're not sure that they are able to bring independent judgment to bear about how well it's being executed. So we had, again, a really helpful conversation around that. We just recently received some very specific suggestions for possible areas that we might look at doing some things in addition to that which is envisioned or required under state statute and rule as part of the environmental review process. So what are some additional things we could do to enhance the process while maintaining, of course, consistency with what's established in statute and rule? And so that's the conversation and the thinking that the three agencies are engaged in right now. I don't know, Michelle, if you have some additional insights.
Thank
to
you.
Add.
That summarizes it very well. I would say that, you know, what we definitely were hearing and taking away was a not unique to this project tension between a very complex scientific and technical project with many stakeholders and groups that feel perhaps an imbalance in the resources they have to analyze it, you know, not being able to necessarily hire consultants to help them interpret documents and things, and feeling maybe perhaps an imbalance. So again, talking about ways within the existing process, if the process were not changed, to enhance their ability to, as Nirmore said, understand and provide relevant information in the right time. We're all aware as agencies within this legal construct and timelines and an expectation of predictability and timelines from the project proposer that there's a tension between how much you can do and add into a process at the same time trying to see where we could enhance and make it more accessible or more understandable for the public. We think that's a very valid question and probably a broader public policy debate than just this project, and certainly something that this board is very well situated to think about and to talk about going forward on future projects as well. We will continue to look at that for purposes of this project too, but it certainly doesn't just affect this one alone. And we had, a very useful dialogue, and we'll continue with some of these groups on that.
Any comments to the presenters?
Mr. Chair?
John?
In light of what's happening out at Standing Rock with the North Dakota Access Pipeline and some of the things we heard when people came to talk to us and at some of our prior meetings, how is tribal consultation going? Can you talk a little bit about that?
I can tell you that Commerce has had formal consultations with Red Lake, White Earth, and Mille Lacs, and has had staff-to-staff with all of those, plus Leech Lake and Fond du Lac. And Commerce is committed to actually meeting with all the tribal nations as soon as possible. So this is part of our formal consultation policy that we've just recently established. But we've definitely been working very hard to establish those relationships.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Kristen.
I'll pass. I think it's for later. Thanks.
Anything else?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Stein. Just for Commissioner Rothman, perhaps it's untimely, but I know there was a docket open on procedural evaluation of environmental review requirements or the rules that the PUC had established, and perhaps I'm misspeaking, so I'm just trying to put that in context. Just trying to remember what PUC's decision was about the broader scope of environmental assessments in their decision-making process, and if there is going to be a further conversation that's already opened on that, or where the board and the PUC as the and its designee, the Department of Commerce as an RGU, where that stands, I guess, is my question.
I can start, but Mr. Seifer will finish. But we actually, EQB, PUC, and Commerce have all met to discuss that very thing and are committed to continuing those discussions.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I think to kind of
to build off that a little bit, you know, the jurisdiction that the board has is over environmental review and alternative review. And so I think we've had a discussion across the agency about, you know, in light of the Court of Appeals decision, you know, how we can, and in our rulemaking docket that's come before the board, what is the point at which we can have that dialogue with the board over what is the appropriate review requirements for linear pipeline projects?
And just to sum it up, it started, and the goal is to, objective is to take into consideration what we've learned and to move forward with improvements as we go along. But the staff are engaged on it.
Good.
Did you have something else, Kristen?
Yeah, I didn't want to raise it, but as long as Commissioner Stein did, I wanted to just make a very simple observation about the importance of the issue of the alternative review processes and how that contributes to the confusion that citizens have and how they're going to participate. So I just wanted to put that on the table and hope that we talk about it some more. Thanks.
Anything else?
Could we just for clarification, though, for the audience and for the board, line three that three agencies are collaborating on right now, it is subject to an EIS, correct, or alternate? Could you maybe clarify that?
Yeah, we've not changed the process. They're still doing an EIS for line three. They're not using the traditional alternative review, a CEA, that you find in the rules. So
the EIS procedure is
being revised. Nothing changed. When Enbridge withdrew Sandpiper, we continued forward with the EIS for line three.
Okay. We have a number of individuals that wish to comment. Is there any other questions by the board before we move on to that? Okay. Thank you very much. Let's see. We have seven commenters, and we've got about 40 minutes left till the meeting adjourns. Should be plenty of time if we just divide that up, you know, roughly 5 minutes per commenter. I'll try to keep us on schedule. Our first, I will take these in the order I received them. Our first commenter is Willis Madison. And I think, Willis, you've provided a document as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is Willis Matson. I'm from Osage, Minnesota. I've been functioning as a citizen advisor and advocate throughout the process. And you might recall that, as the slide shows, I was here several times in this past spring advocating for improved environmental review process, including a possible change in RGU. At the time of your decision not to grant that change, we had significant discussion about ways to make improvements in involving citizens more meaningfully and thoroughly in the process. And as the presenters from PCA DNR and Commerce mentioned, we've had our first introductory meeting, and I'm gratified with the characterization of the progress that was made between citizens and in that regard. I would like to actually give you a little bit more of the detail of some of the proposals we met and we mentioned in that meeting that are being considered, and we're hoping to get feedback on it. But I have to say that Melissa Kakuski from the PCA stole my thunder. Almost all the things she described in doing the work on the Clean Power Plan and environmental review and that kind of thing are virtually identical to what we're suggesting be the status quo for citizen engagement in environmental review. So take a page right out of that book, and my compliments to the PCA and PCA staff, Commissioner Stein, that they're on track. I was going to refer to other resources outside of the state of people doing this, and we have people right in the agencies already doing it. We just need to transpose that into environmental review, especially in a big controversial project such as the pipelines. But part of this involves communication and ensuring two sides hear each other. And technical people don't always communicate with citizens, lay citizens, that well. They think they are, and then they also think they're hearing what citizens say, but they're not. A key person in those things can be a facilitator, professional facilitator, that makes sure the speaker and the listener and vice versa actually know what each other have said. So we're suggesting that that be an integral part of this process and possibly future processes for public involvement. Retaining the service engagement of a citizen engagement advocate, that's different from the facilitator. It's a different skill. It's someone on the staff who makes sure that the documents being produced and opportunities for input and comments are actually flowing. They make sure the information is flowing. Scheduled a timely series of topical forums around the state so that people understand the evolution of the process as it's going along. It's insufficient to have a bite out of it at the beginning and a flash at it at the end. There's room for meaningful engagement of citizens in the process, and I'll give you an example of how that's being done elsewhere as a template. We would like to have actually a meeting of the state and federal agencies that are involved in pipeline projects because citizens don't understand who's doing what, why the federal government agencies seem to be standing on the sidelines when federal rules require that they be involved and state rules say that that's supposed to be. We don't understand why they're not at the table, and if they have been, we don't know what they're saying, what they're doing, and how they contribute or are not to the resources being applied. Here's where I found I got one-upped by Melissa's presentation. I was going to schedule some presentation to the EQB, the PCA, and PUC, and others on public engagement and civil governance. And I was using this resource, Daniel Yankelevich, with Public Agenda, a national organization, nonprofit, who specializes in civic engagement. You obviously have been reading some of his work because what you presented or what Melissa presented was right out of his textbook. But then the other part that I mentioned in previous presentations is that I don't believe the state agencies are really fully aware of the symptoms of regulatory capture. They're so subtle as to be unrecognizable unless you see them from a 10,000-foot level. And I would suggest that you bring in this Scott Hemphill, who wrote the paper that I shared with you. I don't know if any of you had a chance to read it. But I think it would be very helpful as to see where the pitfalls are and how we get stuck in a paradigm that does not allow us to see the full picture. Further, in restoring public trust, we really do want to suggest that there be an external panel of peer review used to restore the trust on the technical matters. As was mentioned by the agency representatives, there's difficulty in understanding the technical issues and whether or not they are properly treated. Some of us are scientists, but most citizens are not. And to ensure that the project is being looked at with what we call objective skepticism. If that's an unfamiliar phrase to you, it's what scientists do to each other when they do peer review of scientific work. They take a look at it in an objective but critical way and actually try to find the flaws. Because if you can eliminate the flaws, you know you've got a good project. And someone writing a document does not see the flaws of their own work. You need the fresh outside view of that. Citizens should not be your peer review. That should come from a panel of experts, so we suggest that be done. And then we would like these ongoing technical presentations out in the project area communities where the citizens can access. It's a 3.5-hour drive for me down here. I don't mind making the trip because you have been so generous in affording us time to come and speak our mind, but not everybody can do that. Not everybody I talk to about this today's presentation could come down. Many have, but many of them are local. So we need you to come out and talk to the communities and the citizens out there. And then the final one is to establish a standing citizen advisory committee. And this is something that I think we can take lesson from what happened with the Exxon Valdez spill in 1989. This was after the fact. After things go wrong, people have a much clearer vision of what they should have done before it happened. So we can benefit from them by saying we now can do what they see should have been done up there. And I draw, and I will make available to you, from a paper presented by Dr. John Devins, who was then, at that time, mayor of the city of Valdez. He's now director of the Prince William Sound Regional Citizen Advisory Council. And he made this presentation in 2000 of all places in Michigan where they had the Kalamazoo spill. Apparently, they may not have been listening to what he had to say. Because his primary findings was that there were four contributing factors to this Exxon Valdez spill. And see if this doesn't resonate. Leading up to the incident, the oil industry failed to maintain adequate prevention and response systems. Regulatory agencies failed to protect the public resource because of ineffective or inadequate monitoring, oversight, or enforcement. State and federal agencies were unwilling to pass laws strong enough to protect the environment and give regulatory agencies the funds they needed to protect the public resources. Items 1, 2, and 3 here are all symptoms of regulatory capture that I would like to have you strongly consider. And then the other one is on us, citizens. Their citizens were asleep at the switch also. They were not paying attention, holding agencies accountable, holding oil companies accountable. That's why we're here. We now are paying attention. And we would hopefully have your attention suggesting these are some of the ways to avoid their mistakes. What Alaska did after the fact, after they had a spill, they created this advisory council. And this advisory council was mandated by federal law. This was a federal response to what the citizens up there said fell apart for Alaska. And it was well-funded. And guess where the funding came from? It came from the oil companies. But they gave this council authority to effectively recommend changes. And there's a report I will give you as to what some of the significant changes they made that have pretty much kept the oil in the pipe and in the tankers ever since. And they also had independence from political and economic pressure. And the mayor does a good job of explaining how they did that. They maintained an independent authority of their own staff, and they could recommend just anything they wanted and then see to it that people listened. They published a report that I will make available to your staff and the board members and the public. and that's just out, is was 25 years of citizen involvement following the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And that was just produced in 2014. Many of the things we're asking for here are what they're recommending. And the reason they produce that report is so that other people don't have to repeat the mistakes they made. And so we can do a better job. Citizens have a meaningful role, as was presented by Melissa. Citizens have a way of thinking things of things that agency people just don't. It's not a flaw of the agency staff. It's just that they operate in somewhat of a silo. So when you bring it out and put it on the table in front of folks out there who really think about this, are interested and also impacted, be doggone if they don't come up with some novel ideas of ways to do things better. That's what they found up there, and they continue to do it. So as the commissioners, assistant commissioners of the agencies mentioned, we did run into some obstacles for doing some of the things we suggested. Guess what they are? We don't have time. We don't have the money. We don't have the staff. We don't have the authority. And maybe we don't even have the political will. Well, we're here to suggest that if we don't do this, we're really condemned to repeat the mistakes of others. Why would we do this? What's the rush? I know that the draft scoping document for the EIS is coming out. I don't know what the public participation element of that will be, but I'm willing to bet that there's some flexibility there. And I believe there's funding available because, as we all know, the applicant pays. And if you haven't submitted the bill yet, Commissioner Rothman, I suggest you hold the placeholder for additional funding of a more robust public engagement process in this EIS and use this EIS as a model for future EISs to follow in terms of the public engagement in the process to gain that public trust back and to restore that kind of credibility. So with that, I did give you a statement, and I don't think I will take more of my time because it is limited. I would like you, though, to take a look at what on this statement I point out as what citizens might have or could have and really tried to help the Department of Commerce and PUC avoid. We now, in hindsight, have 2020 vision that we advocated so hard to not define the project pipeline project is carrying oil to Superior. We were rebuffed in that. Turns out, Enbridge now is willing to pipe oil from the Bakken to Patoka, Illinois, by a totally different route. So by giving in to a project purpose statement like that, we eliminated the very alternative the company chose. How can that happen? Proper and meaningful citizen engagement, we can avoid those kinds of pitfalls. But please, bring us to the table as a friend, an advocate, a supporter, and a colleague, not as an enemy, not as an opponent. And I think we'll have more meaningful involvement. So thank you. I appreciate that. Any questions?
Questions for Willis? Mike?
Thank you, Willis, for engaging with our staff. Applaud you for your efforts and to work with us and suggest your ideas. You know, there is a difference between the Sandpiper, you know this pretty well, between the Sandpiper purpose and project and the purpose of the Line 3 replacement, which is to take an old pipeline and try to fix it. The current condition is not in good condition. And so this is a broad question, because in your note here, I quickly read, you talked about or suggested delay, and you questioned whether or not, you know, what's the rush. My question for you is a big question. From your perspective or citizens' perspective, if you feel comfortable with that, what's the public interest in terms of, yes, delay or expediting fixing Line 3? Is it to fix it as soon as we can, or is it to delay it a little further? from the overriding, you know, the overall goal? Just if you can comment on that.
Well, it's a bit of a false choice to say we delay or risk, take risks. What I'm suggesting is a more thorough, skeptical review than what we've been performing thus far. The onus is on the company. If it has a line that is so decrepit that it cannot safely transport oil from point A to point B, they shouldn't operate it, or they need to find a way to operate it in a way that is safe. The PCA has, and even from my time with the agency back in the 1970s, pointed out to the company that this line was leaking like a sieve. And only under negotiations with the company did they reduce the pressure to try to keep it from bursting every month as it was for a while. So it's incumbent on the company to run a safe business in Minnesota by whatever means that takes. It's surprising to all of us that it didn't upgrade or replace or repair that line adequately to continue it in service. If it's not adequate for service, take it out of service. Yes, we need to take a hard look at how do we continue to supply the energy needs of the country. But let's not let them rush us by the fact that they failed to prepare that line and maintain it and operate it in a fashion that does not threaten our environment. That onus is not on us. That onus is not on the citizens. It's not on the agencies. It's on them. So I understand that now they want to rush. But the whole project changed when Sandpiper fell away because the route of Line 3 realignment was predicated on the fact that Sandpiper apparently could not go in that same route because of the resistance of the Leech Lake tribe. That's no longer on the table. And as a result, citizens now are stuck saying, we gave you comments about two projects in one. When one goes away, we're looking at a totally different picture with a totally different purpose, with a totally different set of options. And to move ahead quickly, yes, does serve the company, but I'm not sure that serves the public interest. So hopefully that answers your question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Willis.
Thank you.
Next is John Munter.
My comments here.
Is this on? Okay. Mm-hmm. My name is John Munter from Warba, Minnesota. I've been also very disappointed in the process with DOC, PCA, and DNR. It's been a failure for us so far. No time, no money, and that type of thing, and hopefully things will change. I like Willis's projection there of what we should do. And in a practical level, I think we should have topical meetings on a lot of these issues involving these pipelines. Some of us are very informed on the issues, and a topical issue on abandonment issue, topical issue maybe on the economic need for the project, topical issue on climate change and the extent of the project and that sort of thing. But first of all, I want to suggest that why I'm here is to come to some sense of standards that we should have for these pipeline projects, for this Line 3, for example, that we should all be able to agree upon. And so first of all, the fact that the DOC, the PCA, and DNR decided to publish the scoping document shows their disdain for public process. It doesn't matter at all what it contains. The fact is that it would have totally changed our testimony. I mean, we had no chance to consider old Line 3 or debate it with Southern Routings or focus adequately on abandonment of old Line 3 or property owners concerned about it or tar sands or where new Line 3's oil is going. We were chasing rabbits down a rabbit hole here on Sandpiper. And we have to have a whole new set of public hearings without question. Nevertheless, I will address the standards for a new scoping document and the EIS to follow here that I think we should agree upon. Routing, last year the PCA and DNR testified that they preferred a different southern routing than Enbridge's preferred routing through Lakes Country. Now, with the withdrawal of Sandpiper, it will be a great shock unless they affirm that again or suggest putting Line 3 back into its own footprint, which makes the most sense if we have it. Number three, Sandpiper again. Well, if Enbridge complains, but wait a minute, we need the new corridor because we want to do these pipelines consecutively, then we need a really robust DOC argument making the need case. I mean, half the Bakken oil is going by train. The other half is probably going by Dakota Access, and Bakken is beginning to peter out as well. The production per well is now dropping, and any future Sandpiper will really just be a Trojan horse for Alberta tar sands in the very next few years. Any new pipeline approval should not happen without an agreement to pull up old Line 3. I mean, there's no state or federal law on abandonment. So that this POC process we have is the only possible hope for landowners to not have their equipment damaged by falling into a rusted old pipes down in future years, their waterways rerouted through rusted old pipes, their wells not damaged by old leaks that take decades to wend their way down to the groundwater. I mean, Line 3 has 900 anomalies. How many of these are microleaks showing slowly wending their way down to the groundwater that should be remediated? This PUC process is the only chance landowners have, and it should be part of the deal. The cost would be spending for Enbridge, but only a fraction of 1 year's oil profits probably on Line 3, so it's quite doable. Number five, any new pipeline should involve government-to-government consultations with tribal officials that respect treaty rights from the 19th century. Otherwise, you know, any permitting will be liable to federal lawsuits in the future. Number six, scoping and EIS should involve the full environmental impact from Alberta to the Gulf and to the East Coast. Climate change analysis should include not only the alternatives of wind and solar, but also the climate impact of cheap and abundant Saudi oil versus the carbon-intensive Alberta tar sands. Economic analysis. We need a true and honest evaluation of the global economy that's not dependent upon rosy prognostications by government agencies influenced by the oil industry. The fact is that the national economy is weak, the global economy is weak, the world oil reserves are bursting. There's no immediate reason to think demand will increase. The Chinese economy is weak. Chinese consumers are too poor to increase by much their purchase of automobiles, requiring more oil imports. And new well drilling in Alberta really needs an $80 barrel oil price that is not going to happen, so bitumen volume there will peter down. In terms of trains, if trains are discussed, then the sparkling new train car standards imposed by Canada and the U.S. should be evaluated, which they were not last year. The attitude that translated down straight from the governor was, well, obviously pipelines are better than trains. That's obviously not true, and especially now with both countries acting to fix the problems and upgrade the bomb cars up to a couple grades higher of cars. Number nine, pipeline quality. A recent problem that has risen is that we have become aware that a lot of cheap and defective pipes have been imported, and Enbridge has been slow to come up with sales slips of its stored Line 3 pipe. Did this pipe come from a bankrupt company with defective pipe from a developing nation? Inquiring minds want to know. So hopefully that's in the EIS. Number 10, will the EIS include any risk analysis since groundwater studies of the water-rich areas of northern Minnesota are very limited? Number 11, are spill remediation plans any better than last year that were criticized by legislators in terms of equipment and trained personnel locally? And number 12, the scoping document should address northern Minnesota vulnerability to solar coronal mass ejections. Where we are 10 times more vulnerable here because of our geology to the power grid being fried, which then goes down and exposes a nearby pipeline possibly. If the power is out for days or weeks, where is the cleanup team? So these things can happen. They happened in Quebec, and they happened in 1859, and these pipelines go on forever, so this can very well easily happen in the future. And number 13, will the DOC, PCA, DNR, ALJ, and PUC take seriously any of our concerns, or will it just be in, you know, all in favor say aye again in the next agenda item? So we're hoping that there'll be some progress here, and you'll maybe keep this handy, you know, when you read through the scoping document and the EIS in the futures to take a critical look at these things. So thank you very much. Any questions or?
Questions for John? Thank you, John. Thank you. Next is Bill Adamski. And we have about three minutes for testimony right now. We're going to try to adjourn timely. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak on the Line 3 replacement project. My name is Bill Adamski. I'm retired, but I come from Wisconsin, where I spent 30 years working for the Wisconsin DNR in environmental regulatory management. As Commissioner Landwehr would know, my duties were probably more akin to what the MPCA position is. Wisconsin DNR is a super agency that envelops both of the duties for the MPCA and the DNR. Anyway, since we don't have the DOC scoping study posted yet, I'm going to submit a few oral comments on what I submitted to the docket on comments for this proposed scoping study submitted, folded in with the MIN 350 comments back in May. And I limit my discussion points to those regarding the around the abandonment of Line 3, which has been touched upon by previous speakers. It's this line currently in the ground is considered decrepit by even in so many words from the Enbridge's permit application. And there's a number of considerations that need to be put into place that hopefully will be addressed in the DOC scoping study, such as inert gas being used to fill the existing Line 3 pipeline and whether or not that can be feasible, considering that it's acknowledged that there are many pinhole leaks in the existing line. Subsidence in the line and how that could be from just leaving it in the ground. The quantifying soil erosion, channeling of runoff, residual contaminants in the existing Line 3, delivery of any unwanted or excess oil in the landfills that is captured from the abandoned Line 3, the future costs associated with the abandonment that would be incurred possibly by the landowners. This includes exposed pipelines, sinkholes, pipe corrosion, pipe and removal, etc. The existing Line 3, of course, is in the main line, is separate from what's being proposed for the new route. And, of course, other speakers have touched upon whether or not this needs to be revisited of putting it in the corridor that was supposed to include the now defunct Sandpiper line. And then finally, there's the whole issue of whether or not it's maintained that Enbridge claims that they cannot remove the line because of its poor state. In the environmental impact statement on the same line for the final 15 miles of the pipeline, proposed pipeline, and this is for both Sandpiper and Line 3, that was done by the Wisconsin DNR that was submitted in February of this year. They mentioned that with soil erosion and slope stability, concerns for pipeline removal are similar to those for pipeline construction. Consequently, and this is a quote from the Wisconsin EIS on the Sandpiper and Line 3, if the trench used to remove an existing pipeline can also be used for replacement, ground subsidence would not occur. Consequently, the EIMS identified those segments of the existing Line 3 where there's adequate room in the Enbridge pipeline corridor for the Line 3 replacement to be laid within the same trench using to remove the existing Line 3. I'll terminate my comments with that, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. Mm-hmm. Next up is Catherine Zimmer. Okay, thank you. Catherine Hollinger is up next.
Thank you, Catherine.
Hello, everyone, and it was really nice to hear that about pollinators. Something wasn't as contentious, and I agree with Willis Mattson that hearing about citizens' input is actually being welcomed and part of the solutions to problems, especially in pollinators and clean power plants. That's a wonderful feeling. I don't necessarily get that feeling all the time when we work on pipelines. I enjoy reading the state environmental policy, and I was pleasantly surprised to see Sam speaking about it. But I read words like say that the state policy is to promote efforts that will prevent or eliminate damage to our environment, and that part of our goals or roles is to fulfill the responsibilities of each generation as trustee of the environment for succeeding generations. I love those words, and I believe Minnesota has them as state law, and we should follow them. I have a bunch of smaller comments. I'd be very, very grateful if climate change was addressed in this scoping document that we were all hoping and checking our phones every 15 minutes to see if that scoping document came out. Minnesota 350 submitted extensive comments, and I noted that the people who were talking about the technical nature of this, you know, I and other people at MN 350 have devoted 3 to 4 years learning everything we can about pipelines. And I don't believe that everything is super technical. There are some things that are clear. For example, if you're transporting oil from the tar sands field in a rail car, you can put more of the product into a rail car than you can in a pipeline. In the pipeline, you have to dilute it up to 40%. I mean, simple things like this we have included in many of our comments. And it really bothers me. I'm sorry. I use footnotes. I do everything I can to cite sources, and I know other people do at MN350 as well. And when it doesn't show up in a scoping comment or in a final analysis, and it's a critical piece of information, that just strikes me as kind of odd, and I mention that. Also, Willis Mattson was talking about the establishment of a citizens' advisory board. I'd like to mention that I've worked a great deal at the legislature, and I helped to get some spill response plan legislation. And there is a statute already on the books. It's 115E.04 that says the commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Ag, or is Fredrickson, he's not here, or Department of Public Safety may reestablish or request, a local official may request a commissioner to establish a citizens advisory group following a discharge of oil or hazardous substance. It's already on the books. It's already a law. We could use it. I would also like to point out in the question that Commissioner Rothman asked about the urgency of possibly replacing this Line 3. Enbridge and the Pollution Control Agency have known for years that there were problems with Line 3. In 2003 and 2007, I have copies of documents where the PCA wrote to the PHMSA at the federal level saying, we recommend replacement of this line or severe restrictions. Now that we hear that there's 900 anomalies on it, now we're hearing it's somebody's crisis. Again, I've told you this before, but I'm a mother. When we hear from our kids that they didn't plan correctly and all of a sudden something's a crisis, we do say, hey, you knew about this for years, and all of a sudden it's a crisis. If this line failed miserably tomorrow, we know that they would shut it down. They would have to. And maybe we need to shut it down now if it's in that bad of a shape. So I just recommend that. water issues are very important to us as well. There's many of like the Straight River Aquifer, the Pine River, Whitefish Chain. There's many bodies of water that we care about in Minnesota greatly. There's never been a proper risk assessment done in Minnesota. I certainly hope in this scoping document when it comes out that they do the proper risk assessment by independent professionals. They look at the different kinds of oil that could be transported on Line 3, whether it's, you know, dilbit, heavy tar sands, or syncrude. These are important things to MN350. Again, we'll be watching that scoping document very carefully because we made a lot of comments, and not everything is so technical that it can't be understood by people who've been working on this for 4 years. So with that, I'll say thank you, and that was my testimony.
Thank you, Kathy. Yep. Next up is Jerry Striegel.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for this hearing. I'm Jerry Striegel. I've been in St. Paul for 22 years. I suppose I would title myself as a climate change mitigation activist wannabe. all right. And, okay. Anyway, if you will, I won't take much of your time. I wanted to suggest that as a foundation of this board, I reflect on the Declaration of State Environmental Policy and specifically the state responsibilities in view of the preponderance of climatologists' forecasts and the amazing manifestations that are turning up every day, that the responsibilities of the state, of the board, are to address those changes. And I would like to say that a fault with this particular statute is that it's very passive. The state may. I would like to see that change to must. The state must. And specifically and with regard to the line that's being considered, the state must discourage ecological unsound aspects of population, economic, and technological growth, and develop and implement policy such that growth occurs only in an environmentally acceptable manner. The state must practice thrift in the use of energy and maximize the use of energy-efficient systems for the utilization of energy and minimize the environmental impact from energy production and use. the line three comes into question without any thought at all the moment that you consider that the fossil fuel reserves that are being extracted in a wellhead or mine-to-wheel overview are 20%, on the order of 20% more polluting than our conventional stock. We have ample conventional stock. We don't need to tap into something that gets us to climate change situations that we cannot deal with. That sums that up. The only other thing I would like to address is the assistant commissioner from the DNR that spoke earlier talked about confusion. I'm one of the people that submitted input for the draft scoping document. And as I understand it, that the final is to be released today. And I'm wondering why there isn't any exchange between the input of the citizens and groups before we present a final scoping document. That's all I have. Thanks for your time. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Jerry. Our final commenter is Andy Pearson.
So many chairs to pick from up here. Which one will it be?
The one with the microphone that's on.
That's perfect. What do you know? Thank you so much. My name is Andy Pearson. I live in Minneapolis. I've lived in Minnesota all my life. And although I am a millennial, I'll assure you I'm not texting on my phone. It's just my notes to keep me concise here today. So thank you so much. So I want to make just a few comments and specifically want to talk as the perspective of somebody who attended one of the most recent meeting with the Department of Commerce and agency leaders around the process and coming up with a better public engagement process and what that might look like. And first, I want to second everybody who's expressed appreciation for that process and the extraordinary step of the agency heads of taking the time and space to meet with citizens and have an open dialogue, and it's so appreciated. I want to go back to something, though, at that meeting, in the way that we began it, that set the stage for some of the dialogue and which I've seen continue here today, that perhaps isn't the most helpful for getting us on the right track. And that's in particular that several agency representatives who were there opened that meeting by saying, you know, this is actually very common that citizens in particular feel like the environmental review isn't done right. We always get complaints that we're too on the side of the corporations, that citizens don't have a voice, that the process is confusing. This is all very normal, and in fact, we expect it every time we engage in this process. Because it's normal, we feel pretty good about it, and so we're going to kind of set that aside. We don't really need to do much about it. So just stop just a minute there, right? If you know and expect to get complaints every single time that a process isn't serving the citizens, maybe that actually doesn't mean it's normal and okay. Maybe that means it's time to seriously rethink that process. And in fact, you can rethink it in a way that is pretty well informed, because by those same agency leaders, they have several years of experience of hearing the same criticisms, and yet they feel good about running the same process again and again, up to perhaps this point where the citizens have gotten, you know, able to begin to have that dialogue. So it's encouraging to me to see that changing, but I want to just note that just because informed unhappiness of citizens is, in their own words, the status quo, that doesn't mean that it should remain so. And I want to make that point very clear. I also want to talk about the scoping process and the scoping document that is still scheduled to be released today at some point. I want to just note that the decision by the Department of Commerce to go ahead with releasing that doesn't bode very well for this process and engagement, and that has been brought up by other speakers prior to me. I won't spend much time on it. I will just say that, you know, you can't just use a bottle of whiteout and cross out the references to sandpiper and expect this document to be done and to accurately represent the way that citizens and tribal members feel about these issues right now. I think that's been covered pretty well, in particular with the routing question. And then there's one other issue I want to bring up too, which is the no-build option and how that plays into it. In the time since citizens were invited to provide input, the U.S. EPA and Department of Justice reached a settlement, the consent decree, around the Kalamazoo spill, which, as many of you know, also contained a number of provisions around Line 3, and two of which I want to highlight on. One is that if the Line 3 replacement, which is in fact a larger, newer pipeline in a different corridor, and we know that, if that's not constructed by the end of 2017, there's just a litany of additional safety provisions that are automatically applied at that point in the consent decree, which is active right now. And so that's perhaps a direct response to Commissioner Rothman, to part of your concerns about safety. There is change coming for Line 3, whether we build a new one or not, as part of that consent decree. As one of many reasons, and others have brought up, that the state agencies raised the safety concerns for over a decade before anything was actually done here. The other thing, where's my notes? Other thing that I want to say about the consent decree and what's in it in regard to the Line 3 replacement. I'm losing my train of thought here, but I'll get it back in a second. Is that the no build alternative for this line is something that was on the table in a very different way prior to the consent decree and prior to the Sandpiper pipeline not being in this corridor. So definitely something that has invalidated a lot of the citizen input that was provided, and to fully incorporate that would require another round of that and not releasing the document today. That is all that I have. I appreciate very much the chance to listen and to hear and understand. I hope we can continue in a collaborative way on this, and thank you so much.
Thank you for your input. And thank you, everybody, for your input. That concludes the agenda today. Is there anything else for the good of the order? If not, is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Tom?
Second.
John? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. We're adjourned. Thank you.